I don't know nothing about planning no insurrection. But maybe my staff did.
It's showtime.
Okay, Tokyo, South America, Australia, France, Germany, UK, Africa.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go, off and running for this 26th day of October 2021. There are two broadcasts remaining in the month of October here at the Horn. That would be Thursday and Friday. Remember, no program tomorrow because I've got an appointment way far away in Huntington. Hi, I'm Robin. And, if you'd like to be part of the merry, wacky, zany, real-time multimedia extravaganza that is the Horn chat room, pop right over to headon.live, where you will be immediately greeted by the early arrivers. And by that, what we mean is Anatole and Squeaky, capably moderated by longtime, inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, although he's a third-stage guild navigator, does not care to fold space into the man cave today, because it may just get a little damp out there.
Mm-hmm.
Expecting possibly some rain later tonight. But nonetheless, it's just a lovely day there in Northern California. And it's a great day to be inside.
Yeah.
Great day to be inside here, too. We've got all of 60 degrees here in the fabulous Horn Studios at the magnificent Kincaid Mansion. And it felt like, you know, yeah, the warm part of autumn was really, really over today. I had to go to Beckley, and it was every bit of, 45 degrees.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. And it's weird. A couple of days ago, it was sunny and somewhat warm, and all the sunlight just danced off the autumn colors of everything dying, because that's what autumn is, everything dying. It was gorgeous. And today it's a different kind of gorgeous, because everything is gray and clouded over, and the background is gray and wet, and the autumn colors are far more muted, earth tones instead of jewel tones, I suppose. But nonetheless, it was a good day. It was a good day. And the countdown is on. Today is 2 weeks to surgery, precisely 2 weeks, leaving Monday, remember. And there will be some broadcasts. Once we're down there before surgery. Like I said, I'm anticipating we will have a Friday on the front porch on Friday the 5th of November. By the way, every program here at the Horn begins with gratitude. This program is no different. And that means that we send out thanks to our 26th day of the month subscribers, and that means thanks indeed to thanks to Ralphs, and thank you to Max. Max jumped in. Fundraising goal to finish the week and the month is at $750 bucks, and hopefully we can knock some of that down this evening. And the goal would be really to kind of have, have a fundraising-free Friday on the front porch. That would be lovely, if possible. So we'll take it from there. Thank you again, Ralphs, and thank you so kindly to Max jumping in. Much appreciated. And if you want to help out, of course, you know, the PayPal interface is over at headon.live right there on the main page. Easy, easy, easy. And we'll see where we'll just see where the rest of the program takes us this afternoon, this evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I'm inclined to get things started with on this Titanic Tuesday, because it is. Remember, it's Titanic Tuesday. That's when we celebrate manifestations of Titanic intellect. In and among the right wing. And we have plenty of fodder, plenty of grist for that mill. Oh yeah. And let's see. What I mentioned in the cold opening. Let's not save that for later. Let's do that right now. Because this is just too much. You might recall that Mo Brooks, Les Brames of Alabama, is being sued. He's being sued by members of the House of Representatives for his role in fostering and furthering the attacks on the Capitol of January 6th, 2021, and the attempted insurrection, the attempted overthrow of constitutional governance in the United States. And there are still some, and I don't know why people are still calling them rioters. They are insurrectionists. They are traitors. But there are some who are still being held in the same wing of a Washington, D.C. jail. You might recall that Scott McFarlane of Washington, D.C.'s NBC4 is and has been doing yeoman coverage of the prosecution of these god-awful maggots. And he reported that, well, the lawyer for one of these maggot traitors, Thomas Sibick, who is being held in pretrial detention because he cannot be trusted to behave himself out of court. He has begun asking the court to please put him in solitary confinement because the other maggot insurrectionists are getting kind of nasty. Scott McFarlane reported, hearing in high-level January 6th case of Thomas Sibick beginning. He once released from jail, but he says he's volunteered for solitary because of friction with other of the insurrectionists. This is one of the people who assaulted an officer, stole the officer's badge and radio, and has entered a not guilty plea. He comes from Buffalo, New York, and is one of the ones who is said to have assaulted Michael Fanone, Metro D.C. officer Michael Fanone, took his radio, took his badge, after another of co-insurrectionist by the name of Cosper Head from Albuquerque dragged Fanone into a crowd of rioters, and Sibick took the badge back home and buried it in his yard. Sibick is pleading the affirmative defense of, oh man, it was an accident. Really, it was an accident. But by way of trying to make the case for letting his client out on bond, an argument he made before Judge Amy Berman Jackson. His lawyer said that, and I mean, I think this is worth paying attention to, that the environment in the jail is toxic. And attempting to appear to be a dutiful officer of the court told the court that he questions whether it's a good idea to keep holding the insurrectionists in a common area or, you know, together. Because now there is something, and other outlets have reported on it as well, there's something called the Patriot Wing of the D.C. jail. And Vice News talked to an extremism expert who also said it might not be the best idea to be keeping them all together. So for one thing, every night at 9 o'clock for lights out, they all sit there, you know, I don't know, maybe they're dragging their little tin cups back and forth on the bars. No, they can't have tin cups. They'd make a shiv out of it. But they stand there and they all sing the Star Spangled Banner. Knowing them, they make an extra effort probably to sing the verse about, well, all those Trumpy things and Francis Scott Key had in common with them. Ugh. And Judge Amy Berman Jackson then said that serious questions are being raised about whether the maggots should be allowed to be together. Jonathan Lewis is a research fellow at the George Washington University's program on extremism. And he said, I do think the fact that the J6 defendants, God, J6, please. I prefer maggots. I just do, because they are. I do think the fact that the J6 defendants who are currently being held pre-trial, having them all together where they can seemingly communicate by newsletter, is likely to foster continued feelings of anti-government mentality among those individuals who are being prosecuted. Does some of that language bother you? Because it does me. You know, anti-government mentality. I mean, I guess it. But is it really anti-government mentality? Because, see, they would be pro-government as long as Nitwit Nero was at the head of it. So they're not just a bunch of... It makes them sound like they're some sort of anarcho-syndicalists. No, they're just maggots. Quit calling them anything but Trump supporters. Trump supporters, Trump supporters, Trump supporters, Trump supporters, because Trump supporters is what they are. They were there to overturn the government of the United States and install Donald Trump as a dictator. It couldn't be any plainer. And as long as we continue to dance around that reality, that furthers the idea that they're going to do it again. But I mentioned Mo Brooks, Les Brames of Alabama. Holy shit. He's upset because Rolling Stone, a story in Rolling Stone noted that he's one of the key members of Congress who spoke on planning calls for the rally on January 6th. You know, the nudge, nudge, wink, wink rally that turned into the insurrection. There were a bunch of other Republicans involved, but Mo Brooks was part of it. And a far right wing asshole named Ali Alexander said Mo Brooks helped come up with the idea about the January 6th insurrection. Ali Alexander, in a video that has since been deleted, said, I was the person who came up with the January 6th idea with Congressman Gosar, Congressman Mo Brooks, and Congressman Andy Biggs. We four schemed up on putting maximum pressure on Congress while they were voting so that who We couldn't lobby. We could change the hearts and the minds of Republicans who were in that body, hearing our loud roar from outside. Well, yesterday evening, Mo Brooks, Les Brames, decided to have a little talk with some reporters. I didn't do no planning for that event. I don't know if my staff did, but if they did, I'd be proud of them for helping to put together a rally lawful under the First Amendment at the Ellipse to protest voter fraud and election theft. No, it's a real quote. I mean, funny accent and everything, but it's a real quote. Isn't that O.J. writing, "If I Did It"? Well, I mean, no, I didn't plan the insurrection, but, you know, my staff might have done that. And this goes with the fact that he has previously confessed that before he went and spoke to the assembled gang of barking, frothing, howling, grunting, larping, smollicking, grabulating, screeching maniacs that went on to try to overturn constitutional governance, that, well, he realized it'd probably be a pretty good idea if he was to wear body armor there when he spoke at the Ellipse. Body armor. Mm-hmm. But he had no involvement in planning the January 6th rally. Here's a hint. I mean, this guy's a real fucking genius. If you direct your staff members to participate in planning an insurrection, you've participated in planning the insurrection. This guy's a real Perry Mason, I tell you. It's almost like he's got a noble pleader like Matt, "It Just Gates Worse" for his lawyer or something. If they did, I'd be proud of them for helping to put together a rally lawful under the First Amendment at the Ellipse to protest voter fraud and election theft. Oh, no. Shut up. Yeah. Oh, what a bag of cats he is. Nope. Bad idea, says Megan. Why give him a chance to gather and plan the next event? No fucking way. Well, right. Keep him in, but maybe it's time to separate him out. Maybe put him in, you know, it's like Maggot, MS-13, drug dealer, arsonist, and make sure that they can't foster the next one. I agree, Megan. I agree. I mentioned Cosper, who's this far out of Albuquerque, and Steve said, "Looks like someone should have taken a wrong turn at Albuquerque." Yeah, here we are, Pismo Beach and all the clams we can eat. What do you mean I'm in D.C.? Well, let's go have an insurrection anyway. Call it solitary for Snowflake, Leah New York says. Insurrectionist just wants to be alone. Oh, I know. Stop it, Robin. They do not know the whole Star Spangled Banner. They probably get the few words they know wrong. Their favorite verse about Washington's forces protecting the airports. Or the Bowling Green Massacre. Don't forget that. Jesus, and the Republicans are out there hollering about how Joe Biden is dementia. Yeah. So that. But let's check in on another maggot there in the Congress, shall we? Representing Troy Nehls, N-E-H-L-S. Troy Nehls of Texas. He's fairly new to the Congress. He'd only been in the Congress for 4 days when his actions on January 6th drew attention to him. He's got 25 years in law enforcement. He was actually the high sheriff of Fort Bend County, Texas, and a major in the Army Reserve. and he helped to barricade the doors to the house floor. And then he posted him posted a heroic photo of himself on January 6th, standing next to a Capitol police officer with a gun drawn and pointed at a rioter looking through a broken window. It's funny how quickly they forgot. People who had to be rushed to safety to keep the mob from, you know, stringing them up on the gallows that they brought with them. We'll hang Mike Pence from the sour apple tree. We'll hang Mike Pence from the sour apple tree. Yeah, right? Because they were doing that? They were trying to find the treasonous Mike Pence, the treasonous to them as far as they were concerned, so that they could execute him? Well, it's all changed for Representative Nels. He went on Newsmuck, where he promptly participated in the growing conspiracy theory that, well, on the one hand, you got the maggot we talked about here, the maggot who said, no, Ashley Babbitt ain't even real. I know everybody in San Diego, if I don't know them, I know somebody that knows everybody in San Diego, and we done looked around, and she ain't there. She ain't real. She's probably made out of a Bill Gates 5G zombie material or some such. Oh, well. So back at almost a year ago, January 15th it was, he was interviewed by Olivia Beavers, Congressman Nels was, and he said, officers would have been totally justified if they'd shot rioters. Rioters. Trying to get on the House floor. And she, Olivia Beavers, taped it, of course, because smart reporter. Well, how quickly it changes. Now he says that Ashley Babbitt was murdered, trying to climb into the speaker's lobby. Murdered. You know, the killing of a human being with intent and malice, aforethought, planned, laid out. Her, we're going to get, no. But the cost of maggotry is so high, isn't it? You must be down with the complete orthodoxy of maggot world. What's next? Matt in San Francisco asks. Are we going to hear the insurrectionists in jail have access to Facebook? Oh, I'm sure they already do. Bear in mind, if this was somebody with skin darker than a brown paper bag, there would be hue and cry. It ain't supposed to be fun to be in jail. How come they're getting food? Why ain't they on bread and water? Because that's the essential cognitive dissonance of right-wingery. It's awful. Just awful. And, you know, cops. Oh, my God. There's a video that's making the rounds now of a woman with a little babe in arms. She uploaded video from her Ring doorbell to TikTok with a bunch of hard-working law enforcement officers who identify themselves as U.S. Marshals. Who come to her door demanding to be allowed entry, guns drawn. Ah, Jesus.
Okay, shield. Matt's supposed to be bringing a shield.
I got the bulletproof vests on. The vests say police. They're pointing their weapons directly at the door.
Hello?
U.S. Marshal, come to the door.
I'm putting my dog in his cage.
All right. Tell him to come out with his hands up. We know he's in there. The place is surrounded.
Nobody. Nice here. Okay, hold on. I'm coming.
Yeah. Hold on here.
Nina, stop.
Send in Shamar. Tell Shamar to come out. We know he's in there. There's only one problem. There's no Shamar. And the woman inside doesn't know who Shamar is. Never heard of Shamar. You got a baby and a dog.
Oh, my God.
We got contact. They got a ring. They know we're out here.
They got a ring. They know we're out here. Get contact. Hey, are we at the right place? Don't matter. We got contact. Hoo-ah!
We got a shield coming or?
Come on out.
Tell him to come out.
Tell him to come out.
Shamar, U.S. Marshal, come to the door. Put your hands up.
No, I don't even know what Shamar. My husband's in the...
Because these geniuses are at the wrong damn door. They did all the work because they're going to get that desperate criminal Shamar. But they couldn't be bothered to make sure. Well, it says right here on the Google that it's got the little red pin dot there. We're at the right place. There's only 6,000 apartments in this complex. Gotta be that one, ain't it? I mean, they got a ring. They know we're there. We going to shoot anybody? Because he actually said that. We got a shoot coming up. Kind of excited, kind of eager. Hey, we're going to get to use our guns. Well, I got to tell you, I mean, I got to give credit where credit is. That's a desperate-looking baby in her arms. Probably all lawless and stuff. Oops. Wrong place.
You guys came to the wrong apartment.
You're right. Yep, you're good.
You guys came to the right wrong apartment. Yeah, you're right. You're good. See ya. Hoo-ah. God bless America. Blue Lives Matter. They were fully ready to blow her and her baby's brains out. And this is one of the ones with a happy ending, where they didn't. Anybody remember Breonna Taylor? They shot her dead in her sleep. Well, see, the system worked. No. And it be in Florida, and it's probably some sort of drug crime. And it could have easily just one itchy trigger finger more. And it could have wound up with a dead mama and a dead baby. And Matt in San Francisco asks the bottom line question. Would she still be alive if she had been black? And I think it's really easy to reach the conclusion that no, she would not have been. Breonna Taylor didn't make it. Even though she was sound asleep. There's a look. I know the maggots and the Blue Lives Matter assholes and everything get all worked up about it. But there is a conversation to be had about just exactly what it is we have police for. For this? For a bunch of fuck ups? Showing up at the wrong door. Hey, we gonna shoot anybody today? I got my bullet. Now, Barney, not so fast. We might be at the wrong address. You came to the wrong address. Yep, you're right. You're good. And man, they got out of there in a slap hurry. Somebody's going to get, well, sovereign immunity, of course. Limited immunity. These guys have no business being on the streets. Guys like this are nothing more than the biggest gang in town. That's what most police departments are. You can't sue them when they don't protect you. Because the courts have held time and time again, the police have no duty to protect anybody. Except maybe another cop. This is just awful. Awful. Breathtakingly horrible. The potential for tragedy is almost you don't even want to think about it. How easily it could have turned into another nightmare. And then the cop union guy would be standing there saying, you know what, our brave officers put their lives on the line every day when they go to the wrong apartment. I'm so old I can remember when they showed up at the wrong apartment in Atlanta and started busting in, and a grandmother, thought she was the victim of a home invasion and did what the NRA and all the other gun humpers want people to do, and she started shooting, and they blew her to pieces. Because they were in the wrong. They were in the wrong place. They had the wrong address. But there's a Supreme Court case that goes back a few decades called United States versus Leon. And it says that you don't have a Fourth Amendment right for the cops not to fuck up and kill you. They went to the wrong address and the Supreme Court said, that's okay. As long as they were acting in good faith. As long as they believed in good faith that Shamar was in there, even though they were at the wrong place, how can you believe in good faith that your quarry is in a place that you have no evidence to suggest your quarry is? There is a legitimate discussion to be had about who and what the police are. Is this country, as awful as it can be from time to time, that bad? Or is it just wall-to-wall chaos nonstop? I mean, there are some bad actors in a country of this size. You're going to have some. But almost every problem that we notice, some sort of a social ill, has been created. It didn't spring up spontaneously. You have criminals because of the nature of the laws that we impose. I mean, how many doors were battered down over the course of generations over somebody with pot? Right? I mean, everybody out there is not El Chapo. Everybody out there is not Al Pacino in Scarface with an AR-15 shooting up the joint for the fun of it because he's just pulled his face out of 3 pounds of blow. It is an actually far more banal country, really. But we have a law enforcement mindset. Law enforcement themselves have a mindset that says, no, it's a war zone out there. Because that impression has been carefully cultivated over the years. But if we say any, if we talk about any of these things, God damn it, liberals, you bunch of snow, you want to cancel the police now because wrong address. And shit. I mean, not all cops, right? I mean, if one bad apple don't spoil the whole barrel. Yes, it does. And the funny thing is, we have an opportunity right now to have meaningful police reform, if you think about it. All we have to do is fire the assholes who won't get the vaccine, and that's probably going to get rid of a hell of a lot of your bad cops. Because if you're an anti-vax cop, you're not much into upholding the law when the law says you got to have a vaccine, right? Yeah. No, you're fine. You're fine, Jack. Jack was in Shreveport. It was a little bit late catching up. I thought more in Monday was yesterday. I've lost track of what's going on. Maggot overload. Dumb cops should be on Monday, shouldn't they? Sign me lost in Shreveport. You're fine. You're fine, Jack. Jack said, I think I get it now. Yeah, I sent my previous email just before the answer was made apparent. I feel like I should be on more in Monday sometimes. There's a lot of overlap between More and Monday and Titanic Tuesday. Sometimes it's just a matter of the day of the week. Because morons often display Titanic intellect. Yeah. Oh, by the way, I got a nice conversation coming up at the top of the hour. A dear friend of mine of years and years and years and years, decades, in fact, Roger Hurricane Wilson, a just mind-blowingly brilliant blues artist on guitar, will be joining us in conversation. And that's around the top of the hour. I'm looking forward to it. He's got a new CD out called A Spiritual Awakening. And the official release date on Blue Storm Records is November the 1st. But you can get a signed physical copy at app.getresponse.com. And it's all about positivity and recovery. And it's meant to be an uplifting effort. Among other things, Roger's been named Best Guitar Teacher of 2018. He was inducted into the Oklahoma Blues Hall of Fame in 2015. I met him when long ago when I was a little radio newscaster at CNN. And so I'm looking forward to that conversation coming up shortly. As to police and police violence, Dave Number 11 says, no, Robin. If and you're in Boise, you can go to the park or the mall and live free from gun violence and chaos. Never mind. Yeah, not so much. Out in the desperate hinterlands. Billable Rick has awarded a cowbell to Jack in Shreveport. I think that's well deserved. You're kind and generous, Billable. And Steve in New York points out, subject line, the police, and he's not talking about the band. I've asked this question to people, and they think I'm joking. What exactly do cops do? And it's not a joke. I see them sitting by the side of the road, sitting in the median, in speed trap towns. What are you doing? Well, I'm waiting to bust somebody desperately driving more than 6 miles an hour over the speed limit. Because we can't raise taxes around here because we got a bunch of Republicans who think that's communism. But we got to get paid somehow. Steve says, I'll give you the response from my aunt whose daughter, my cousin, is married to a sergeant whom we will call Cop in Dayton, Ohio. As an aside, the last I checked, Cop was unvaccinated. He's a beat cop, and his 2-year-old daughter is immunocompromised, having had a liver transplant during the Christmas holiday after she was born. My aunt's response, "What do you want it to be, like the Wild West?" Well, that's the thing. I mean, the Wild, really? Dodge City? The desperate dust-covered towns of where things like the shootout at the OK Corral took place? That was not Dodge City. That's Kansas. You couldn't carry your firearm, your shooting arm, into the bar or the body house. You had to leave them at the door. And oddly enough, the same people say, "What do you want to be like, the Wild West?" This country got along fairly well for a significant portion, maybe fully half or more of its existence, without cops. Yeah, but it's a more modern society now, and everybody's got a gun. No. No. And by the way, I had a note from Ron in Raleigh. Build back, not at all. Being a pessimist, because, you know, cops are infrastructure, too. Funny, Republicans don't have a problem understanding that cops are infrastructure. But it's too damn much for them to understand that somebody who takes care of your grandma in her home that's not infrastructure. And if we treated caregivers like that, like human beings, Joe Manchin is absolutely convinced that we would become an entitlement society and we would no longer reward hard work. Well, the problem with people like in-home caregivers is they do the hard work, they just don't get the reward. And I don't think it's communism to try a little harder to make people's lives a little better. I mean, where does a jackass like Joe Manchin think that the extra money that goes into people's pockets is going to be spent? I mean, they're not like Joe. They're not going to found a coal brokerage and sit there and suck up government coal subsidies. They're not going to stash the extra money away in the Cayman Islands or a Swiss bank account. They're going to do what working people do. They're going to spend the money. They might eat a little better. They might have a washing machine that actually works. They might be able to make the payment on a better car that'll actually last long enough for them to, you know, get another 100,000 miles out of it. Entitlement society. Build back, not at all. Ron in Raleigh says, being a pessimist, the amount of the plant... Now, get off of that. You're a pragmatist. We agreed yesterday. The amount of the plan that the Democrats are calling some sort of victory has been whittled down to what your senior senator has said he could abide. $1.5 trillion over 10 years. Fuck me. The Democrats have been rickrolled again, only this time all the Republicans had to do was stand back and let the Democrats fuck themselves. Well, a couple of Democrats fuck all the other ones. I'm not quibbling, but I think it's good that we keep things. I mean, I'm not mad at Bernie Sanders over what Joe Manchin did. I'm not mad at Dick Durbin. I guess I'm not even mad at Chuck Schumer, and that's really hard for me to say because I mostly am. I think we need to keep the focus exactly where it belongs, on Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, with a little left over for people who enable him, like Chris Coons in Delaware. Sorry, he does. I'm developing, Ron says, a real hatred for your attention-seeking senator. Oh, no. I mean, I know you got a few years on me and everything, Ron, but, you got a lot of catching up to do. Okay, because mine goes back decades. With these kind of representatives, do we really need Republicans? Perhaps we'll get down to the Yukon Cornelius amount. Oh, my God, a Yukon Cornelius amount? It's not even Halloween yet, and you're making Rudolph references, Ron? Come on! Perhaps we'll get down to the Yukon Cornelius amount, which is nothing. Nothing! Yeah. Nothing there for me to argue with. It's frustrating as hell. $1.5 trillion, 10 years, $150 billion per year. Hell, I think we probably spend that on bootlaces in the military budget. Wait, do boots still have laces? I don't know. No, you weren't confusing at all. Her implication was if we got rid of cops, if we got rid of cops, which is my desire, that is what it would be, the Wild West. Sorry if I was confusing. You weren't confusing. And funny how the Wild West is always west of the Mississippi. There are photographs to be seen of West Virginia somewhere between 1900 and 1913, because that's when West Virginia jumped the gun. See what I did there? Gun. And imposed prohibition ahead of the rest of the country because the coal camps was getting a little liquored up. Which was really great for self-starting entrepreneurs who wanted to make their own liquor. But and people are standing in bars with revolvers pointed at each other. And the barkeep standing behind the bar with his arms crossed, he's got his little bartender apron on there, and his arms crossed across his chest like, well, you fellas, go ahead and get it over with. And there's a whole bunch of those photos, and a lot of them were shot maybe about 10 miles from here. It's a longer drive than you'd think 10 miles is, because 10 miles is a lot longer here in the hills. And you can still see, like, the promotional artwork of the girly pictures. They were paintings back then on the wall, and women weren't allowed in there. And there's row after row of various and sundry bottles of hooch. But you know what did happen back then? It was a lot harder to control, say, coal miners who finally, after decades of abuse, got sick and tired of being treated worse than a draft mule. That's why the geniuses got their old rabbit guns and whatnot, and marched on Logan County, and were met and engaged in battle at Blair Mountain, West Virginia. Federal government got involved, sent aircraft. Billy Mitchell wanted to just bomb the shit out of them, but he didn't quite get his way. There are photographs of biplane aircraft parked on a flat space along the Kanawha River. That was the United States Army Air Corps, fresh home from the Great War. And I guess that's maybe what they're, because that brings us back to the insurrection of January 6th now, doesn't it? Seems fairly clear that somebody stood somebody down in the hope, because in the hopes of seeing this thing succeed. We saw it early on in video. You saw it, I saw it. When members of the police moved barricades to let the insurrectionists have access to the building. It's a hell of a thing. So I think it's a fair question to ask. You got one of them babies in there, we're going to have a shooting situation. Tell the baby to come up with his hands up and his diaper clean. Yeah. Steve in New York says, Ron and Raleigh, I'm inclined to agree with you. I'm in rare agreement with Monday morning quarterbacks on a number of programs I watch who say that the Democrats should have struck while the iron was hot right after the COVID relief package passed and the GOP was talking about Mr. Potato Head and Dr. Seuss. However, I think it's fair to keep these numbers in mind. The congressional makeup in 1933 after FDR took office, House 313 Democrats, Senate 58, 59, or 60. I'm thinking that may be a really big factor. A lot of people on the left are forgetting. We talked about that last night, yes. Those brief shining moments when we actually get things done that are good for the American people are oh so rare. Because the government is largely designed to maintain stasis. And support the status quo, whatever the status quo is. And, you know, Matt in San Francisco's got it pretty well nailed down. $1 trillion. So let me get this clear. The Democrats think they're going to be transformative by spending $100 billion a year on infrastructure, but we keep spending $750 billion on weapons and death. Matt muses. I wonder how that's going to turn out. They might as well roll out the red carpet for the fascists. And see, that's another thing I was thinking about. We all do remember that after the Beer Hall Putsch, a certain political party in Germany, well, a lot of their members were sent to prison, where they had a lot of time to sit and think. And when they got out, well, they just got right back together again. Y'all, they're gonna do it again. And again, and again. But you know what's causing the real problems? I mean, we talk about police violence and things like that. Well, we need to check in with representing Bob Good. He's a good God-fearing maggot from Virginia. And he knows, and because he said so today on the floor of the House, that the problems we have in Merca, well, he knows where they come from. In just a sec. Okey-doke. So, Bob Good, you know, we've got hunger in this country. We got poverty in this country. We got people who have, I mean, how many thousand orphans did we have in that story a few days ago as a result of COVID? But, well, there's a governor's election in Virginia coming up, and I guess Bob Good was trying to sort of indirectly help out the GOP nominee who has spent a lot of time wallowing around with the people who hate other people for how other people love each other, that kind of stuff. Bob Good had the answer.
It's recognized.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I yield 2 minutes to the gentleman from Virginia, Mr. Good.
The gentleman from Virginia is recognized for 2 minutes.
Thank you. Person Speaker, I rise today in strong opposition to H.R. 2119.
Wait. Person speaker? Okay, there's no way that's not, no. This guy must be vying with Jim Jordan for, well, never mind.
The other side of the aisle claims that this would help families, but instead it would devastate them. The bill would coerce faith-based providers, as the gentlelady from North Carolina has already said, to violate their deeply held beliefs or stop their work altogether. It would redefine the definition of sex and it inserts gender identity language into U.S. code. And isn't that the objective of this administration, this majority, to force faith-based providers out of business and to redefine sex and to change the identification of gender? My colleagues on the other side claim they want to protect the family, but instead they've chosen to attack the very bedrock of our country, the moral principles and the traditional family that hold our families and communities together. In fact, nearly everything that plagues our society can be attributed to a failure to follow God's laws for morality and his rules for and definition of marriage and family.
Yeah, you know, like, stoning disobedient children when they get mouthy, because that's in there. All kinds of stuff. Not eating shrimp. That's rules for the family. Not wearing cloth made from multiple different fibers. Yep, Bob Good, he knows it. Yeah, that's where all the problems are. Yeah, marriage equality, dadgummit.
The very name of this bill is steeped in irony, the Family Violence Protection Act, as it would truly inflict more violence on unborn babies' lives and force taxpayers to fund...
You know, I don't think he really understands what violence means.
...fund the murder of unborn life.
Again, murder. Malice aforethought. Just like they run around saying Ashley Babbitt was murdered. Never mind.
And consistent with the goals and objectives of this administration and this Democrat majority. This would be a bad bill without its attack on the unborn. This would be a bad bill without its dangerous sexual orientation, gender identity provisions, or SOGI. This is a bad bill because it spends over $1 billion more in expansive, intrusive government. Violence is already illegal. We Republicans are against it in all forms.
Violence is already... Hey, he's carrying over the talking points from the NRA. We don't need more gun laws. It's already illegal to hurt people with guns. I mean, we got into the horse of law. Oh, God. Well, to be fair, though, Glenn Youngkin, the guy who's running for governor in Virginia, I mean, he's been cashing a lot of them big old government money checks from outfits that talk... that create these talking points. And so, I don't know, maybe Bob Good wants to get in on some of that action. That is ultimately where this kind of stuff leads. God. Everything that plagues our society can be attributed to failure. Oh my God. Rules for morality. And of course, the time that he's talking about, and most Americans don't know this, and that's what they depend on, women were property. That's why biblical marriages are attended by the swapping of a woman for some camels and sheep and goats and ducks and chickens and whatnot. It's a property exchange. It is a sale of a human being. But, you know, it was an empty house, and he was just creating a soundbite for his next campaign fundraising video. Hey, Virginia Double X Fox, yield me 2 minutes. I gotta do a campaign ad. Ugh. Oh my God. So, you know, we've just spent the last hour in a wander through the swamp of the Kulturkampf here in the country. I like it when we get a little chance at relief. And that's what I've got right now. As I mentioned earlier, Roger Hurricane Wilson is somebody I have known, 35 years, something like that. And it is nothing if not pure joy to watch Roger in performance. He can make the strings of a guitar smoke and almost yield up sparks. And so it makes me very, very happy to have my dear, dear friend Roger Wilson on the line with us now. Roger, how are you, my friend?
Well, I'm doing mighty fine, and I guess basking in the sunlight of some wonderful comments you just said there, for sure.
Well,
thank you.
That was not exaggeration. It is absolutely true. Let's do just a, you know, we've talked before, but for anybody who isn't familiar, Let's just do a little overview of your long and storied history with the blues.
Well, I started out playing guitar at 9 years old back in 1963, and I just always loved music. And then when I was 19 years old, I decided that I really just wanted to play, you know, full time. And I started teaching as a result of trying to find a better job than what I could find regularly. And I started teaching guitar lessons because I had taken lessons as a kid. And a lot of the music that I was influenced on through the 60s and the 70s were all pretty much blues influenced. It was rock and roll and hard rock as far as we were concerned, but basically it was blues. And then basically I talk about going to an Allman Brothers Band concert back when I was 17 and walking in and standing in front of Duane Allman about 8 feet away, and that kind of ruined everything for me. so then I so anyway, it pleasantly ruined my life. And then I got started studying the history and just playing. So I'm not really what you would say a blues man or a blues guitarist, but I'm very much influenced by it because I'm a guitar player first, but I love that the music, and I've just I guess cut my teeth on it and been doing it all these many years.
I think you undersell yourself a little bit, but I mentioned earlier before you dialed in, we met in 1987 in the halls of CNN Radio, and that was your keeping the lights on gig, I guess, of sorts. And then you were playing in the bars and music halls and whatnot of the greater Atlanta area. And it remains one of my great pleasures to have seen you play a few times back in those days. And I remember them still, as just wonderful evenings.
It was funny you mentioned that because, I mean, I've had a dual career basically in broadcasting. I started out doing part-time radio in the 70s and started out at Georgia State University on 88.5, and then I started working freelance around Atlanta. I was producing the Braves and the Hawks and doing part-time radio and developed enough of a resume to where I got to CNN in 86 and got on the radio network there and did that for 2 years. And that was full-time, but I was still playing full-time, probably a little too much around Atlanta. But then I migrated up to TV in 88 and worked up there until 96. But in the meantime, I had a producer that a friend of mine who was playing bass with me at the time, and he said, we need to put a CD out on you because you're burning yourself out in Atlanta. Cause there was a time in town where I was playing probably every night somewhere, and nobody cares about you when you do that. You know, they can say, well, I can see him anytime and blah, blah, blah. So my buddy said that, you know, we got to get national, and he put a CD out, and then the Hurricane moniker came along. That was something that he kind of threw in there because of, there was a little story behind it. And that kind of took it out. And then I went around and got more national, I guess, as far as a career goes, nationally than anything. But, you know, but now I'm back home a lot in this day and age, the way things are, but I'm still doing a lot of radio work and putting out, I've got a new CD coming out this week, and it's my 27th, and I'm getting more airplay around the world now than I ever have looking through a windshield 60,000 miles a year.
That's fantastic. And the attention is well deserved, Roger. Something that should be mentioned in along the way, because it is, it's a significant portion of your story. And it is not easy to do. You were talking about playing in bars all over Atlanta. You were doing that at the same time as you were in recovery, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no doubt. That's the only reason I was able to do it is because I was in recovery. I'm 38 years this past August, as a matter of fact. But basically, there was a time when I had the Roger Wilson Band together. That started back in 1978, and that we had a good run there for about 5 years. I mean, we were open for big shows. We were open for guys like Albert Collins and 38 Special and doing a lot of big shows and then playing regionally around Atlanta. But we had the biggest bar tabs in the Southeast, and it was a badge of honor at the time. But that fun time kind of ended quick, and so it required a reevaluation of what was to lie ahead, either go down or stay standing if I could.
Well, it's an occupational hazard. I mean, it's legendary what the road will do to you in terms of just trying to, and people self-medicate. And in many instances, it's that. It's not, you know.
We were young and partying. I mean, we were, it was fun. We didn't go into it to, you know, to mess up our lives. We went into it to have fun, and we were having fun. We'd party and, you know, I mean, we'd play a gig out on the road. We'd party all night and go back and do it again the next day. If I did that now, I'd be in the bed for a month. But other than that, it was a lot of fun. And we had a great time. But somewhere along the line, it crossed the line. And then it got to be where it wasn't fun anymore. And when something's not fun anymore, and even Elvis said that when he was recording music back in Memphis, you know, early in the day, he says, if it's not going to be fun, we might as well not even do it.
And well, so, what's the point?
Right. So fortunately, I still love music, and my health is still good, and I've just been very, very blessed over these years, and I'm just very blessed. I can't say any more than that, really.
Well, there are a lot of people who are part of our little radio community here who have some things in common with you. I just had a note coming in from our buddy John in Central Pennsylvania, and he said, could you please ask Roger how one gets into playing or teaching guitar for a living full time? He's a 20-year veteran of the guitar and would like to just have it be the life. How does that happen? Is it? I mean, is there some portion of it that's just luck?
Say that again now, that question?
How do you get into a place where you can play and teach guitar for a living full time?
Well, the way it started for me was by teaching, because I had taking guitar lessons as a kid from 9 years old till when I was about 13 or 14. And I was in New Jersey. Now, my mom was from Atlanta, but I was born in New Jersey, and I was taking lessons as a kid because another kid down the street was doing it. And I had a stack of books knee high that I could really read the music and play the notes and all that. And that was cool. I won a couple little trophies on some, you know, recitals, but it wasn't like you were just really playing from the heart or from the soul. You know, you're playing the notes and playing songs, and people are pleased with it and all that. But I was just kind of going through the motions, and so I didn't know if I would ever really stick with it. But then when I went away to school and I stood 8 feet from Duane Allman, that changed my whole attitude to where I wanted to play guitar for the rest of my life. Then I got back home to New Jersey for 1 year when I was 19, and I was working in this crummy factory job. I was going to college to a community college, and then I had a little job, and it was in this industrial section, and it was just a horrible thing. I was taking dump truck loads of ballpoint pen casings from the U.S. government and throwing them into a machine and grinding them up and shoveling them out, and they came out on the other end as the little marshmallow-looking foam packing things that you pack packages with. Now, this was a horrible job, and the conditions were horrible. It was cold. It was dingy. It was rainy, flooded. The place was flooding out. And I thought I was working for about like 3 or 4 hours. I looked at the clock and it was like 15 minutes. And I went, this is not going to fly. So I made it through a day and a half of that. And I walked out and I went home that night and I went into the phone book and I started calling music stores. And I told my mom and dad, I said, I got to do something else here. This is not going to work. So I called to try to get a job teaching guitar lessons. And the reason, I hope this is not being too long and drawn out for you, but this is the way it happened.
Oh no, we want all of this.
Okay, all right. Well, that's cool because I got plenty of time. But I'm just we're saying that I called this music store, and the lady that owned it was really nice, and she invited me in there that evening, and so I went over there, and I told her, I said, she said, well, how long have you been teaching? I said, oh. Well, I've been teaching about 4 years. Yeah, that's the ticket. Okay. Now, and I hadn't never taught a lick, but I had played enough, and I had taken enough guitar lessons to where I said my attitude going in was going to be, I'm going to teach the way I learned how to play. I'm going to take the students in one note at a time, one string at a time. Just that's how I learned. That's how I'm going to teach. I'm going to teach the way I learned, and if I can teach the way I learned, we should be fine. So a few days later, I go back in to go to work, and the lady has a little girl comes in. She's about 6 years old. She's holding a guitar in one hand. And she says, okay, Roger, here's your first student. I'm going, well, all right, here it is, you know. So I start teaching her, and it works. You know, I taught her, and then I got a few more students, and And it worked out to where I was going through the motions, and I was showing, and they were learning, and the parents were pleased, and the store was pleased, and I felt I was onto something. I was going, wow, I'm going to be useful for something in my life, you know, even if it's like throwing a little few notes at some little kids or something. But then I had a few adults take lessons, and it started, you know, really kind of snowballing. So fast forward, I stayed in Jersey a year, but I wanted to get back to Georgia because it's where the music was that I was cut on, and I wanted to get back here. So the next year I moved back, and a friend of mine had put me in touch with a guy that had a music teaching studio himself. It was he was teaching privately in the north side of Atlanta, and I moved into the building he was at. It wasn't really like I was being hired. But he said I could use somebody to come in here and teach and, you know, build the business a little bit. And it was more like an opportunity that I'd have to cultivate myself. So I went in there, and I'm staying in this building and just kind of figuring out, you know, what I'm supposed to be doing. But then I got I started advertising and networking around and got a couple of students, you know, and I started teaching the same way that I was teaching before. And I was teaching note by note and all that. And I had one student, and I had two students, and maybe one quit, and I got two more. And I was just building a business out of nothing. And finally it evolved. And I think in a year or so into it, this kid comes in to me, young kid. I think he's wearing a school uniform, really nice kid. Walked in with a guitar, holding a guitar in one hand and a record album in the other hand. And he says, well, here, man, I'd like for you to show me something I can have some fun with on this album. And I'm not sure what the album was. I think it was Led Zeppelin. Anyway, he says,
of course.
I said, you know, I don't think I was kind of taken back as I was trying to figure out. I understand where he was coming from, but I didn't know that I could do this. But he says, just show me something I can have some fun with, like on this record. I said, well, you don't really know how to play. I really need to show you some basics on the guitar. He said, ah, yeah, man, I know it, but just show me something I can have some fun with. And that was the key. That was the one thing he said that struck me, to have some fun with it. So I put the record on it. Back in those days, we didn't have, you know, YouTube and all this other stuff to go on. We had to put the record on the turntable and ruin the record to learn a guitar lick. That's the way it was. And that's the way I was teaching. And I had a turntable there, and we put the record on. Excuse me. And I'm tuning up to the song. And I wrote my book called Hurricane. It's a biography that I wrote back in 2016 that's out, but it's not a bestseller, but it depicts the whole story just so I wouldn't forget about what happened. And so I told the kid sitting there, and I put the record on, and I think I'm tuning up to the song Black Dog by Led Zeppelin. And it's a simple lick when you listen to it. It's just like a, you know, that kind of thing.
Everybody, and I'm tuning up to the. It's playing in everybody's heads now, just by mentioning
it. Right, yeah. Yeah, and so I'm just tuning up to the record, and I play the lick, and the kid goes, he goes, yeah, show me that. And I said, well, okay, and so I'm showing him this one lick, and it's in the key of A, and we're tuned up to the middle of the neck there, and I'm showing him the three notes. I put your finger here, put your finger there, and play these three or four notes, and just work up till you get that, and then you go up and learn a little bit more, so he's doing that the whole 30 minutes. Of the lesson, and he's just excited, and he's just really trying to eke it out, and he's going, man, I says, I'll have it by next week, man. I said, I promise, I'm going to practice it. You know, I said, yeah, you'll be fine, but I said, just go, you know, go ahead and keep doing it. And then when the kid left, you know, it was almost like, I don't know if this was a spiritual experience or not, but it was almost like the kid was like glowing, and he left, and I sat there in complete utter silence and amazement, and I don't know what just happened, but something happened there where the kid left a lot different than the other students were by just learning how to play the notes one by one. It was just something different. And after that, my phone didn't stop ringing for 10 years, and my kids were carpooling to me to learn stuff off records. Excuse me. And so one kid would get his parents' car at dinner time. And four kids would pile into the car, and each one had a different record album. And one would have, I think, the Rolling Stones, and another one would have Humble Pie. And then I think the Boston album, More Than a Feeling, was the vinyl wasn't even dry on the record yet, and the kids were bringing it in. And So it just snowballed into where I was teaching. Oh, it was unbelievable. And I was making a living doing this, but I felt good about it because it was something, but it just kind of happened accidentally. And these kids were like having a blast. And then the parents were coming to me and going, you know, thank you. Thank you so much. Because I was keeping their kids off the street, you know, and then, sometimes they would have a recital at the school, you know, and I'd walk in to go support them in there, maybe play with them on some of their songs in a recital or something like that. And I'd walk in and you'd think that, Eric Clapton or Johnny Cash was walking into the place. I mean, it was incredible, but I wasn't trying to vie for that kind of attention. I was just doing what I knew how to do that was evolving into something else. And by playing guitar day in and day out, sitting in the studio, teaching guitar lessons I had as many as 65 or 70 students for a while. It was like my head was coming off, but I was loving it because that's how I built my chops. That's how I built my ear. That's how I learned, you know, to listen and play and it was just from that. So your guy called in a little while and asked a question on how do you do it full time? Well, that's how I did it. And then I had a little sideline in broadcasting and I was doing some radio stations on the weekend and then freelanced around, of course, ended up at CNN, but still kept doing it. And then when I left CNN after the merger in 96, I just went on the road and I went to the gig. I had a gig booked that night. I went to the gig and never looked back, but it was constant working and constant toiling. And that's how you do it. Now you do it differently because there's a lot of technology in YouTube and we have more control of our music. We don't have record companies, you know, calling the shots and all that. So it's just, and a musician today all has to be more diverse. You have to generate different income streams. You know, you can generate streams from onstage sales for CDs. You can generate download income. You can generate lesson income because you're not going to go out and just hit the road really and play bars and do it and not without having kind of a hard time. So it's really you got to look at it from a different perspective. If that's anywhere close to answering the question,
I think you do. And John's good, by the way. He's good. Let me ask you, Roger. You alluded to it there. The business has changed. It is not what it once was. On the one hand, the technological advances have meant that in many senses, you can have a studio in your spare bedroom that would have made the Beatles green with envy. But by the same token, all that support that was there isn't there anymore. And you really do have to wear a bunch of different hats. Which is harder, the old way or the new way? And what has COVID done to your ability to keep making music?
Well, COVID was, a lot of people had a hard time with it and suffered, and I hate that. But for me, it was a blessing because I was able to stay home and basically I'm sitting in my office. Now, I've been teaching guitar lessons for 47 years, and I was teaching up until a number of months ago. I decided to lay that down. I still have a couple of websites with lessons on it, but I'm sitting in my office studio now, and everything I do is on my computer. I play all my guitar parts, but I'm playing. I've got some software that will allow me to play my instruments from where I'm sitting, and it's just unbelievable. And I can do that if I need to. Do something. I can go to a studio, but mostly I'm doing it all right here. And I'm also doing some radio broadcasts from here. So it was a blessing for me that I'm able to spend time, you know, writing music and recording now, because a lot of times we're on the road and you sort of think about it and want to get to it. But COVID put me in a situation where I was able to really stay home and actually do it. But the other thing that bothers me about in this day and age, there's a lot of distractions. Of course, we have all kinds of, you know, streaming and downloads and social media. I mean, the information overload that we have is incredible. I mean, and it never was like that before. Now, if you picture and my explanation for it is if you picture back, and I'm really displeased with audiences these days. I'm very unhappy with audiences because music is supposed to be listened to. Now, when you go to a place and somebody's playing, there's musicians, artists, maybe playing the original songs or just playing, you know, a lot of times there's more talking going on than anything else. And I've even seen it in the big concerts where you should just be listening. Now, that's something that's just, I think, a disadvantage of having so much out there. Because back in the old days, now, if you look back to the 50s, the 40s and 50s, probably, and I'm thinking the 50s, when like guys like Hank Williams were coming along and Elvis was coming along and all these artists were coming along pioneering a sound. And the idea was like and Elvis is the perfect example of that. Elvis cut a record and they put it out on the radio and people were calling up to figure out, well, who is that? And so they found that it was this guy named Elvis Presley. Well, then the next step, back in those days, after the radio, you have to go out on the road and play the music so that people can hear the music, you know, and the emphasis is on the word hear the music and listen to the music. So you go out and you play the music. Now they're partying, having a good time, dancing, jitterbugging back in the old days and all that stuff, sock hops and everything. But you went out and you played a concert, like a lot of times they did them in maybe an old school building or a school building or a public building or something like that, and they'd have a concert and you go on the road and play the music and people would hear it and buy the records. And that's how it was, because there was nothing else to really distract them from anything else. It was an escape. But now, where do you go? I mean, you go from one computer screen to another, one device to another. There's a lot of artists out there now. But back in those days, though, the record company had the control, and a lot of artists got ripped off, and they could all tell you about it, going back from Bo Diddley and everybody else. And even, you know, even Elvis, as successful as he was, he didn't get what he should have really, really made because of his management. But then later on, as the technology said, and that's the one advantage that technology has had for us, because we have total control. I can sit here now and run my own publishing company, run my own record company, and I can do my own radio show and radio distribution. I'm with a company now called Airplay Direct, which is an amazing company. I'm not going to go into it, but that's the way to do it for me. And I'm getting some worldwide airplay that way. And so I can do a lot more sitting here. I still love to get out and play, and I still do, but it's not like you have to be a victim of the road and, you know, night after night after night in a joint. It's a little bit more creative now. And it's been a long time coming for that too.
Well, without a doubt. And I think when you talk about people actually listening to the music, I mean, I've seen it in the little community that I have here. There'll be live music in little venues and whatnot. And the artist will be sitting over there playing their soul out. And it's like, I'm old school, so I'm sitting there listening and taking it in and digging it. Got their little screens out and, you know, maybe they're videoing some of it that's what creates virality and, you know, hey, you got to listen to this. Sure. But you wonder, you wonder if maybe the experience is in fact diminished, you know, what would.
I don't mind the videoing. You know, the videoing is cool and passing the music out because, you know, if you're listening to it and doing it for that reason, that's fine. I mean, I understand that. But it's just the matter of the rude conversations that take place that really shouldn't be. In other words, I think there should be a lot of times there should be a section where people can go talk, you know, and then a place. And there are some listening rooms where like, if you go to the Bluebird in Nashville, the deal is when you walk in there, they tell you to shut up on the way in. You know, there's no talking. They don't say shut up, but they do have a motto that says, shh, you know, and that's the way it is. And you have to do that because if not, you're just going to be background music. If you can, like a singer songwriter, if I'm going into a place, like I play a lot of covers that I like. I'm not really one to take requests, but I do play. There's a lot of great songs out there that I play that I like, and I have to play them maybe because the crowd is not tuned into like actually tuning in and listening. But then if I get a listening crowd that wants to hear the stories, I can dig into my own catalog of songs I've written and I can tell a story about it. And people seem to love that more so than, you know, just being background music. And I've been doing this too long to just want to be background music anymore. I just want to really play and have people kind of leave and remember something and think that they got something out of it. I mean, you can go out and make money playing in a classic rock band and make money playing in corporate bands and playing the hits and everything. And, but, you know, people leave and they don't remember anything of, about you. And I would rather somebody just remember something I did that made them feel better, that made it, made the world a little bit better for them. That, and that's important. And that sometimes it's not all about money for that either.
Well, it isn't. And the people who are making an impression now, you know, and not to take anything away from anybody, they're not cover bands. They're writing original material, and there's a wealth of brilliant original material out there. It's almost like it's harder to find now because there's so many different platforms.
Well, that brings up another point. I'm friends with a little Steven Van Zandt, you know, from the East Street Band. He grew up two towns from me over in Jersey, and I didn't meet him until 2018 in Memphis. We talked about it. But I've been to a couple of his workshops because he's got this wonderful thing that he does, this wonderful program for teachers all over the world. School teachers are free to enroll in it and use his material, the programs that he's making, and he's incorporating the history of rock and roll and the history of music where the teacher can take it and hook it into the curriculum, you know, and put it to the kids instead of, you know, and like the kids have got a headphones on, and instead of telling the kid, oh, well, you need to put down and, you know, listen to this. You know, you ask the kid, well, what are you listening to? You know, and you get the kid's opinion, and then you throw in something like, it might be, you go back some years and you say, well, that, you know, that sound probably came from this. Like, in other words, you could, perfect example would be maybe Michael Jackson or Prince or somebody like that, that they're listening to, and somebody even, you know, newer than that. But then you go back into like, say, oh, well check out, you know, James Brown here, you know, and Little Richard and these guys that were coming along and setting the foundation for what you're hearing, because a lot of the kids don't know what the history is. And so it goes back to that. But Stevie also says too in his program that the best music in the world was made probably from 1951 to 1971. It was like, and I'm talking about people like, you know, Sam and Dave and Otis Redding and, you know, just the Young Rascals and all these, I mean, the endless number of great artists, the Animals, the bands that we were listening to along the way that I was listening to mainly the 60s, but I remember them, you know, from the late 50s as a kid. So, but that music also, and you hit the point earlier, see, you have to dig for it. There's good stuff out there, but when we turned the radio on, all that great music and art was commercial. And so when we turned the radio on, that's what we heard. And we were very fortunate to hear that because it was right there for us that we were hearing great songs. You know, some of it was bubblegum, but some of it was R&B, but some of it was blues oriented. I mean, everything from, you know, everything from Bobby Sherman to Cream, you know, that we were hearing on the radio, and it was just all different types, but it was all commercial and in our face. So if you turn the radio on and it's right there, and that's why we were fortunate. That's not the case these days. It's like you said before. Now, there's a lot of good artists out there that are writing some good stuff and everything, but unless you have to dig around and find the good stuff that you want to hear, to listen to. And unfortunately, a lot of people are not willing to do that. They're pretty much really just willing to listen to whatever, you know, whatever is thrown at them.
But commercial radio is a wasteland now, isn't it, for the most part?
Yeah. That's what I mean. In other words, you turn on commercial radio now and you know, you have to go to satellite radio or something else if you want to, and pick out what you want to hear to listen to, you know, to the good stuff. But no, I mean, it's a lot of talk radio, a lot of, and even we had AM top 40 radio when we were, you know, when I was a kid, you drive under a bridge and it cuts out, that kind of thing. So, but I mean, there's a lot of, you know,
or some pimply, but yeah, some pimply faced DJ reading the weather over a perfectly good intro. Yeah, I'm guilty.
There's some, but at least the music was there. You know, we were hearing it when we turned the radio on, and that just doesn't happen anymore. But now there's so much. I mean, the streaming and the downloads and the satellite radio. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, I don't know if our minds could have handled that when we were coming along. You know, it was just it's really just a beautiful thing to me.
Yeah, it is. I mean, so much access. But it does, when it's, and the way it embeds, I was having a kind of a rotten day the other day. You just reminded me of something. And I talk on this program from time to time about old DJ brain. You know, I've got an MP3 player in my head, and I can hear the songs playing back in my head. And I assume everybody's just like that. And I was having a rotten day, and I remembered a lyric from that, and it was just a single, and it was, you couldn't get away from it. Grover Washington Jr. with Bill Withers, and Just the Two of Us. And there was a line about no time for tears, wasted waters, all that is. And just bang, it was right there in my consciousness. And it picked me up and got me through the day. And, you know, I hope that that's still out there for younger generations, because at the risk of sounding like I'm standing in the yard yelling at clouds or something, it really is, you know, coming from that world that you've just described into this modern, it's very much different, because it used to be, it was a lot of fun to go into the record store and say, what's new, what's good. And, you know, they'd put the promo copy on for you. It's like, wow. But you've got a new effort out, and that's really why we're talking to a certain extent. Tell us about a spiritual awakening, would you?
Yeah, well, the songs, going back to, you know, to going into recovery. Basically, I started writing a bunch of songs. I mean, I had really just gotten on a spiritual thing, because, you know, being delivered from the lifestyle the direction I was headed in, you know, and I'm not trying to talk like to sound overly religious, but I'm very spiritual about it, because I think some things have happened in my life that have directed me, you know, from a better path than not.
Let me be really clear. I acknowledge spirituality, and it's a very, very real and moving and compelling thing. It's the mega churches and that's where I part company, because it just seems like it makes it too easy, and it makes it all so transactional. It's kind of like a strip joint or something. You know, you put your dollar in the little dancer's thing, and then, you know, you're good. Spirituality is an entirely different thing, and I've talked to so many people in recovery, and they all share that spirituality in common.
So, no, that's true, but also one of the things that it says, though, like in the book that we read, referred to as the Big Book, there's a part in there where you can also refer to or ask, you know, inquire to people that are formally trained in religion and make use of stuff that they offer occasionally. But this CD that I'm just making now, it's the official release date is November 1st, but we got a few advanced copies going out now. But there's 10 songs on it. Two of them were written and recorded recently, two new songs, but most of them wrote them. Probably 30 years ago, 30 or more years ago. And I went back in the files and pulled them out, and I was going, wow, I'm really kind of pleased that I was talking about this, because I was trying to just get on a more positive plane. And so now what the artwork of this thing, now my grandmother in Atlanta back in the 50s and 60s, when I was just a little kid, she was an acclaimed artist in Atlanta. And she painted this, and I got a bunch of her beautiful paintings that she won awards with in my house now. She passed away in 1981. She was my mother's mother. And, but she was a very acclaimed, talented artist and did some beautiful paintings. Well, she painted this, painting of this church in Atlanta that she joined in 1958. It's All Saints Church in Midtown Atlanta. It's a beautiful church. And I've had the painting with me for a long time, framed in my living room. And finally, during COVID, I wanted to put this, I was putting these songs together and thinking about, you know, something to do that way. And during COVID, this church went online and started broadcasting, you know, on social media, And I started, you know, listening to him, and I told him about the, I told him about the painting, and they were, the rector was very much interested in it. And so I, you know, told him a little bit more, and then I went down there to a service or two, and then I went on some classes, and I decided that I would join this church. I came along in the Methodist church as a kid, but this is the Episcopal church, but that's okay. But I'm really impressed with them because they have a lot to offer. They're very, they accept everybody. There's nobody that's turned away. Because I know in the, I did marry early on into the Baptist church, and you know, it just, it seems like those folks to me were just waiting for me to do something wrong. But anyway, this is kind of an evolution. And, so I put the thing together, and the rector of the church has written the liner notes on it. And when the, when it comes out, it has his paragraph on the back where it's my spiritual journey or spiritual awakening to where I'm trying to trace back to where I came from and what, you know, what I should be doing and what I am doing. So the artwork on the front of the thing is the painting that my grandmother did and won an award back in the 60s. And the songs are recovery songs, basically, and positive songs. And that's just kind of where it's taken me. And it's nothing wrong. You know, I still love playing the blues, you know, but the blues is a whole different thing. That's just because I always loved the guitar parts. And then I realized later on that there was more to it than that. And I went back and studied it, and I'm going, okay, there's a whole thing happening here where people were, and it came out of gospel music and religious music and spiritual music because they were living in depressed conditions. And basically, you know, people would say, well, why do you want to play the blues, you know, and feel bad? I'm going, I said, no, that's not the way it worked. I said, they were feeling bad first, and they started singing to feel better. So the music is a healing power, no matter what the music is.
Yep.
And the songs I wrote are just my recovery songs that are out there now and will be out there, you know, within the next week or two, even more. So, but that's how it evolved. And so I picked up my grandmother's, I guess, picked up where she left off and decided to check into this church, and I really liked it down there, and they've been very accepting, and this, I don't know, it just kind of evolved into this wonderful project that's coming out.
That's just gorgeous. The whole story's gorgeous, Roger. I just love it, and the fact that there's a generational family component where you're bringing your own past along. I've just looked up their website, and I can see where the painting would be absolutely beautiful because it's a beautiful building. So this the CD will be released, and it'll be released online too, as you know, like streaming or downloading, I suppose. On November 1st, have I got that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Matter of fact, we're taking in some advanced sales now on HurricaneWilson.com. The product will be in this week, but I'm doing some signed copies early on. And so HurricaneWilson.com, and there's a little thing for buy music if somebody wanted to just check it out and even get a glance at the artwork and all that.
Cool. So that's where if somebody wants a signed copy, they go to HurricaneWilson.com, right?
That's correct.
Beautiful. I'm going, I'm on my way there now. Talk a little bit, if you don't mind, about just because I'm a gear nerd. You've got to have a whale of a guitar collection by now.
Well, I'm sitting in my office now, but I've got them all mostly hanging up here. I started out playing Gibson Les Pauls, and then I moved to Strats, but I got a Taylor endorsement, so I play Taylor acoustics. I've got about 16 guitars total. They're all working, and I just use them. I've got several that I play live with, and a lot of them I'm still, you know, just doing some recording with. So, but yeah, I guess when I play live, if I'm playing like with other musicians playing an electric set, you know, the Stratocaster seems to be the best, but I've got an old Melody Maker that I play slide on in open D tuning. I got a couple of my guitars are signed by Les Paul. I had the pleasure of meeting Les Paul back in like 03 and made friends with him and his musicians and family. And I ended up hanging out with Les for about 8 years until he passed away. and I'm still in touch with his grandkids, but he was very, very influential just and sitting and talking to the guy. It was amazing how that happened. That was another, you know, story that I wrote about in my book so I could document it.
That's just beautiful. I think it was Kurt Vonnegut who wrote, "I've been a victim of a series of accidents," and victim is the wrong word, but it's those little happy accidents that change lives. I got to ask, because I just loved it when I saw you play it all those years ago. Do you still have that Les Paul Gold Top?
I'm sitting right here looking at it. I sure have. Yes, that's a 56, and it's road worn and torn a long time ago. I don't take them out anymore, but I do. But I have recorded some of the stuff that's coming out. I still record on it. I sure do.
I'll be darned. That's so cool. Tell me.
I met Seymour Duncan at the NAMM show out in L.A. a couple of years ago, and I had a couple of pickups that got blown out, and I replaced them. And so Seymour Duncan set me up with a new one, and I just put that in there about a year ago. So yeah, it's still cranking good.
Still screams.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that's so cool. Tell us a little bit about the Oklahoma Blues Hall of Fame induction.
Okay. Well, there's I was playing a blues festival out there. The festival's called the Dusk Till Dawn Blues Festival, and it's held every Labor Day weekend. And it originated, if anybody wants to check it out, the website for it is D as in dog, DC Minner, MINNER, blues.com, DC Minner blues.com. Well, DC Minner was a older blues man that lived out there, that's from Oklahoma. Renningsville is a little town right next to Chakota, which is where Carrie Underwood is from, but it's also about 25 miles or so from Muskogee. So it's on the eastern part of Oklahoma, right about 60 miles in from Arkansas. And it was one of the festivals that I landed when I went out there. And my band was on the road, and we went in there. My first year playing there was, I think, in 2003. The festival's been going on since 1990, and DC Minner, the blues man that founded it, and he had played out in the West Coast with, he played with Albert King, and there were some other ones. I think he played with Freddie King, and there was some other artists that he had played along with many, many years ago. But his grandfather had some land in Oklahoma, and he went back there, and he and his wife, now his wife Shelby Minner, still does the festival. She passed away about 9 years ago, but Shelby was, she's from Boston. Well, she's from New England, and she was, at the time, DC was an older black blues man, and Shelby was a younger Jewish girl from New England. Now, this is a wonderful pairing here, because he taught her how to play bass and all this other stuff, and turned her on to the blues and the real deal. So basically what happened was I went out there, I got called to play there in 2003, and my band was on the road. I had two other guys with me, and we played, I think, the Hot Springs Blues Festival the night before, and we went out to Renningsville on a Sunday and closed out the show there. And the vibe that I got from the place was just amazing. It had already been going on 3 days. Now I'm coming in later on a Sunday, setting up and playing a set and knocking it down, and then I'm done. And then the rest of the festival goes on. The music starts from 6 in the night and goes till 5 in the morning. That's why they call it Dusk Till Dawn, because you don't want to be out in the middle of the day out there in Oklahoma. It's not going to work. It's just too hot. So it was called Dusk Till Dawn, and I had a great time, and I thought to myself, man, I would love to be here for the whole time. I'd love to just come in at the beginning of it and just experience it rather than having to, run in and play a set and split. And that happened again for another 2 or 3 years. I was on the road coming from somewhere else, like coming from either Texas or coming from Arkansas or somewhere. We were on the road, and the one stop was to play that festival again. Finally, after like 2 or 3 years of doing that, I thought, I gotta get involved in this place. So anyway, I started, I didn't take a band out there anymore. I went out there solo. I'd be on the road somewhere else. In the middle of the summer, I was out playing like RV parks and stuff. And I was just putting tours together with some other rhythm sections around the country, plus doing a lot of solo stuff. And so I started flying in to play it, and I'd fly in a day or two early and hang out and work with him, and then I'd fly back out to finish up what I was doing somewhere else. And I was having a great time. And so I've been teaching some blues in the school classes, like the history of blues. I was going to some schools, and I was incorporating that into some when I found a teacher that was interested in it in their classroom, instead of having you don't want to deal with the Board of Education because they don't care, but the teachers do. So anyway, I got involved in that, and the school there, the band director, Jakota, he was the band director of the high school, and he was also in the Blues Hall of Fame. He was a trumpet player, but he just a great guy and a great band director. And so back in like 07 or 08, I went over there and hung out with him and listened to the kids playing. And I did a little class. And so then I went back year after year. I was going back, and we were doing some, I was teaching them some classes, and we were playing. I was playing with the jazz band, and they would do a set every year. So finally I decided to, the band director and I put our heads together, and he took some of my songs and arranged them with some horn parts. And I started going on the stage with him about 6 or 7 years ago. Every year on Saturday, we'd open the festival, and I'd play with the high school band. And then I would do some other sets with other musicians or play. I'd be there I'd be going in for 4 or 5 days just to be there because I loved it. And I'd work with whoever, and I'd help out. I'd play solo if I needed to, or I'd play with some other musicians or sitting in. It was just a wonderful situation. And they had established the Oklahoma Blues Hall of Fame, you know, way before that. And so after I was there a number of years, Shelby told me, she said they decided to open to establish another category of the Oklahoma Blues Hall of Fame for other artists that weren't from Oklahoma. Because, I mean, you have people like, you know, Leon Russell and J.J. Cale and all these Oklahoma great musicians that were from Oklahoma. You know, and I'm not from Oklahoma. I'm a Jersey boy, you know, living in Georgia, falling into Oklahoma. How does that happen?
Yeah, that was kind of what made me curious, because I knew the New Jersey, and I knew the Atlanta, and I was like, wait, did you like have a great grandparent from Oklahoma or something? Or
it made my head spin too. But anyway, the fact that I got involved in there and I kept going back and playing with them and working with the kids. And finally, in 2015, I put out a live CD with myself along with the Dakota High School Jazz Band. And it's on the website at hurricanewilson.com. It's Roger Hurricane Wilson and the Dakota Jazz Band live at the 2015 Rennesville Blues Festival, Dusk Till Dawn Blues Festival. And it's a cool CD. And the kids, the band director, and the videos are on my YouTube channel too. You can go in there and watch all those performances of where that CD was recorded. The YouTube channel is just simply youtube.com Roger Wilson Guitar. And we're looking for subscribers now. We're really building that up because that's where people are really listening and watching what's going on. And I'm not afraid to, you know, put that out there, but I did do this CD with the kids. And my thought was, these kids are still in high school, and they're going to have a recording credit. I gave them a recording credit. I mean, the CD is available for download. It's on all the sites, and these kids have a recording credit before they got out of high school. Now, if that ever happened to me, I don't know if I could have actually mentally grasped it, because back when, you know, I graduated from high school in 1972, and the only thing that was happening then were big rock stars ahead of us, and that's what we had to look to, and until I realized that I could go back in and find, you know, artists like blues artists like B.B. King and the one and study the guys that really made it happen. So that's how that. So what happened was, after all these years, I was working with them with the high school and playing the festival, and I was just part of it. And they decided to put me in there, and that's how that evolved into it. Sometimes I think about it and I go, how did this happen? I really don't know. But I also attribute my wife, Jolie, is really the one that when I think back, and she won't take any credit for this, but there was one time back around, I guess, 98 or 99, when she was flying back from one of her business trips, and this is around Christmas time. I want to say it was around 99 or 2000, something like that. And she's the kind of person, you know, she'll talk to somebody or strike up a conversation. Usually if I fly, I put my sunglasses on and go to sleep. Now that's that, and I probably have blown a lot of opportunities by doing that. But she was talking to this gentleman on the plane who was flying to the Netherlands for Christmas. But it turned out he was the president of the Oklahoma City Blues Society. And he gave her a card. And she gave me the card later. And then I ended up talking to him. And then he had gotten me over into Oklahoma City to a club when we were touring. We were looking for some joints to play. And he got me over there. And he and I became friends. And he's the one that actually put me in touch, told me about the Dusk Till Dawn Blues Festival early on. And he's the one that told me about it. Then I called them and we talked a while. And then finally the one year they called me back and had a slot for me. And that's when I started playing in 03, which evolved into the whole thing I just told you about. But when you think back about it, it was just that one little contact that made it all happen, that evolved into this thing. And I never forgot that. And I keep telling Jolie, I said, you know, you're the one that did this. I really didn't. She said, you did it. You know, and I said, yeah, I know. I showed up, but you made it, you know, you're the one that made it happen by just having that simple conversation. And so it's, you know, little miracles happen. I don't know. You can't make this stuff up, you know, and that's what I'm a big thing about seeing miracles happen and things happen that aren't solicited, you know, that are not hustled and solicited. And that's kind of something
and as you pointed out so perfectly, we do not always see the shape of the thing when the thing is coming to fruition. You don't know where you're going to end up when you take the first step.
And it's, that's for sure.
Yeah, it seems like that's a lot of your career. I just went over, I looked up Roger Wilson Guitar on YouTube. I just subscribed. I follow you on Facebook, and I love it when, because I'll get a notification that says Roger Wilson's live. I'm like, oh cool, and I highly recommend it to anybody who just, you know, because when I see that, it's like, ooh, I'm going to put everything aside and just hang out with Roger a little bit. And it's delightful. Well, it's absolutely delightful.
Well, the technology is really cool. I'm not doing as many live broadcasts from home as I have been, because I've been doing a few out as a couple of, you know, other gigs that I've been doing. But I love doing that. And the reason I like it, because I can sit there and I've got a setup to where I can go live, for instance, on Facebook and play some songs, but I'll keep my tablet next to me where I can monitor who's watching. And so there's a little, obviously there's quite a delay, but I can finish a song and then I can see who's commented and then I can respond to it, you know, visually over the broadcast, but kind of keep in touch. But people are actually listening. You know, there's really no distraction. Somebody can, you know, you can be in your living room or wherever you are and listen to my show, and I can tell you the story of the song, and then I play the song and you can hear it and get the gist of the story and all that stuff. And there's no extra curricular distractions, you know, like, you know, coffee makers or silverware or dishes smashing or anything else like that. It's just a matter of, you know, you're hearing the thing one-on-one. As the crowd builds, I have a lot of people that are out there and they'll tune in and really enjoy it. And they seem to, as opposed to having to, you know, put up with a lot of nonsense, you know, in a noisy venue. And that's not every venue, but that's a lot of them, you know.
Oh, it sure is. I just noticed you posted one just yesterday, the old Hank Williams tune, Blues Come Around.
Yeah.
That was just, yeah. And it looks like you got a great little setup for is that out behind your house? Got a little stage set up and.
Now that's a place in Woodstock, Georgia. That's a wonderful venue. It's called Mad Life Stage and Studios, and they have a wonderful state of the art stage and everything. Because I cut a live CD there back with my band in 2018. There's also a live DVD from there that's on the website. There's an actual tab on the website at HurricaneWilson.com for the DVD. Because everything, all the shows they do in there, they record them, and then you can go back and pick out the parts you want and then put them on a project. They're doing a lot of tribute bands, and they're selling out a lot of those. But then there's also that, what I'm playing, where you're seeing me there on that video, that's their patio. And it's also, it's just great because there's a sound tech that sets you up and the crowd is there for the music. Sometimes they're noisier than others, but that's okay. But it's all about the music. There's no, you know, no widescreen TVs in there. I mean, it's all about the music. And I've been doing some weekend, afternoons there and just absolutely loving it, to where I'm just, and so I shot that, video. That's from October 16th. I just played there this past Sunday and I really just, got so into the set that people were having a good time. I forgot to roll the video. And then I'm playing there again. Yeah. I'm playing there this Sunday. Well, I have enough material to get away with here to put it up. But then I'll play there again this Sunday on Halloween from 3 to 6. And this is in Woodstock, Georgia. It's called Mad Life Stage and Studios. If anybody wants to see the DVD, they can click on the tab. And on the YouTube channel, all that video is in the YouTube channel also.
Oh, excellent. Wonderful. Wonderful. You know, I saw another title when I was just going through it. One of my favorites, you know, Can't Find My Way Home. Oh, my God, I love that song so much. And I'm all eager because as soon as the program's over, I'm going to just go back and go through and just check some things that I haven't seen or heard before. And it's going to be a blast. What's next, Roger? The release is the first. It'll be the best place to go is HurricaneWilson.com. Obviously, you're playing some gigs close to home. What are any longer range plans?
Basically, I got a little rhythm section I'm putting together down in St. Mary's, Georgia, which is right on the Florida line, just down about, I guess about 90 miles below Savannah, Georgia, but right by Fernandina Beach. It's a little town, St. Mary's, and a friend of mine is playing bass with me. He owns a music store down there called Jerry Lee's Music, and then Jeff Malone is playing drums. He's over from Fernandina Beach. He had put on about 4 or 5 years in a row. I worked with him for the Amelia Island Blues Festival, which went on for about 4 or 5 years, and so I was on that. That was a great festival. They did about 4 years worth, and then it didn't happen anymore, but it was a lot of fun. So this is kind of a little spark of activity that I'm able to do some electric stuff with, and it's just kind of fun. It's getting back to the small venue and a crowd just having some fun, you know, playing some electric guitar and just having fun. So I'm going down there. That'll be on November 6th. But if anybody wants to really keep in touch, I mean, they can send me an email at roger@hurricanewilson.com. And also, like I said, the YouTube channel is really growing right now, and I'm putting a lot of the stuff that I'm doing is going up there. And between that and the audio that I'm putting out, I'm just trying to, you know, keep it fresh and keep it flowing, supposedly.
Yeah, I think you're succeeding. I wanted to let you know that we heard back from John, who had that earlier question, and he just wrote the nicest thing. He said, "I'm going to listen to this over and over. I can't wait until this program's uploaded. I'm inspired. Thanks again." And our good friend Rick wrote with a question real quick. Can you please ask Roger what his major musical influences have been in terms of specific artists in writing and composing his own music?
Well, as far as, you know, I've spent a lot of time in Nashville, and I've been around a lot of songwriters. I've noticed that I've always seen that there's probably no real rhyme or reason to how it happens. I mean, a song can be, it can start off with a guitar lick, or it can be with a phrase. It can be with a groove, you know. So, I mean, I'm so enthralled with trying to get this other product out that I'm sort of not hit a wall, but I'm sort of like, I've got a lot of notes and everything that I go back to start something new. So it's just a matter of another songwriter years ago when I was attending some songwriter sessions, you write a line and maybe the next line should associate with it more. And you learn this over the years, but basically they tell you just to think about what you want to say and say it. And that's kind of where it's at. And of course, being a guitar player, I'm a guitar player that sings. I'm not a singer. And I'm not an entertainer. I'm just a guitar player first. And then I suppose that I thought years ago when I was first out playing guitar, I didn't sing. I was just playing electric guitar, and I always thought that I'd be a guitar player in somebody else's band. And I didn't really realize that, and I was playing all the stuff that I heard. I mean, I was teaching all the, you know, for years and playing a lot of cover stuff, and you do that. I mean, you play the stuff you like and listen to, and you learn from it. But even bands that have come along, like, for instance, the Allman Brothers Band, they were playing cover music when they first started. And somebody suggested to Greg and Dwayne, you know, well, you really ought to play your own music. You know, you ought to write your own songs. And that's true. I mean, it really is. And so a lot of bands that came along that wrote their own stuff, they started out playing stuff that they heard before. I think, you know, Bruce Springsteen did the same thing. I mean, he played so many, you know, Jersey Shore bars and then up and down the East Coast and everything, playing all that stuff. And a friend of his, Carl Tinker West, opened a place in Asbury Park back in like 1969 or 70 called the Upstage. And it was a place that musicians could go. And he said, you can play here, but you got to play your own music. You know, so that inspired them to do that. But once you start putting your own stuff out there, and I had no idea that I'd ever do this, but I started thinking of things that I wanted to say and some guitar licks I wanted to play, and it kind of just evolved into that. So I guess I'm at a place where I never knew that I'd be here, but there it is.
Sort of there, but for the grace of God goes John Smith, right? I mean, and any career is a long series of planned events and unplanned events, and you know, 8 feet away from Dwayne Allman obviously had a big impact on you, but so did Albert Collins, and so did sharing a stage with B.B. King, and
oh yeah.
And
well, the thing with Dwayne Allman, you know, I mean, I'd seen the Allman Brothers playing in Piedmont Park, you know, that summer of 1970, and this was January of 71, but that was the first concert, their big concert they were doing in Atlanta, and they were doing really well, and it was 2 months before they recorded the Fillmore album. But when I went in there, and halfway through the show, I got down there to the front, and I'm standing there, but I'd never seen anybody play guitar like that. I mean, I'd been playing guitar since I was 9, and going through the motions, and I was playing trumpet in the school band, and I mean, I was doing well. I was musically inclined just because it was just fun. I probably sounded like crap, but it was just a lot of fun, you know. And so, I loved it. But when I stood there, and he had the band was watching him, and everything he did, he just flowed from one place to the other, and I was going, oh my, I'd never seen that. And so I was ruined from that day on. I went out of the room different than I went in. You know, I was going, you know, something else happening here that I got to figure this out, you know. But what the other thing was that led me into the blues, and I guess this goes back to your question about, well, how did you get into the blues? Well, after Dwayne Allman passed away, and actually it's 50 years, 2 days from now, that on the 29th of October, 3 days from now, that he passed away.
Wow.
50 years. And that was kind of like a JFK moment for me. I mean, because I was going to Woodward Academy. I was a boarding student in Atlanta, and I was already digging into his stuff and starting to, you know, really get down on it. And that happened when he was killed on the motorcycle. And so it really affected me because I felt really bad. I really wanted to get into his stuff. About a year later, you know, I'm up in Jersey teaching at that little music store that I told you about. And the Dwayne Allman Anthology album came out. And I guess this really puts it in perspective of where the blues hit me. Because inside that album, there was a big paper insert, a big booklet that told a lot of the story of him doing the sessions with Aretha Franklin and Wilson Pickett and Muscle Shoals and Derek and the Dominoes and all this stuff that he did. And he was only 24 when he passed away, and the mark that he left was just like, oh my God, unbelievable. But he was talking in the thing, and he mentioned Robert Johnson, you know, and the article said something about, well, when his eyes would light up when he mentioned Robert Johnson. I'm thinking, Robert Johnson?
Who
is that? You know, and this is like, so I'm 19 years old, you know, figuring this out. And I said, Robert Johnson, I gotta get into that. Then he mentioned Elmore James, you know. Of course, he had played the slide guitar based off of Elmore James tunes and all that. So he'd been, that was another name I had to remember. And then he mentioned Blind Willie McTell, the 12-string guy, but he's the guy that wrote Statesboro Blues. And the arrangement of Statesboro Blues that Blind got was from Taj Mahal. But then there was another, and then he mentioned T-Bone Walker. So here's four blues artists that I had no idea who they were as a kid, but I had to figure out who they were. And so I went to a record store somewhere in Red Bank, New Jersey, and I went to the record store and I found these collections of these artists. I found Robert Johnson. I found Elmore James. They were just reissued in collections. Blind Willie McTell and T-Bone Walker, and I'm walking around at 19 years old with these albums on, and I listened. I put them on to listen. I couldn't hear anything. I mean, these are old recordings, and I put on Robert Johnson because he had written Crossroads and Cream. They recorded Crossroads. The only thing I knew about Crossroads is that Cream recorded it, but now it was a Robert Johnson song, and it was done in the old Delta blues style. And now I can listen to it now, and I can hear it and tell what's going on. But back then I couldn't. My ear, I just didn't have the ear then. But I also would listen to it and go, well, I can't figure any of this out, but I know it's in here. I know whatever it is, I've got to learn it. It's in here. And that's what kind of drove me to understand, to try to understand more of the history. And then now I've been down to Mississippi several times, and I go down there and I just try to soak it in and figure out where they were coming from, and it's a long, you can get lost in it very, very easily, getting lost in one little branch of trying to figure out where it came from. But, and now a lot of it's public knowledge, and, more, some of these guys like Robert Johnson and Elmore James, these guys are all household names now, but they never were before.
No. And, those recordings had to be clean. There was a lot of effort went into cleaning those things up so that they could become more accessible. But
sure. Oh yeah.
But people like Keith Richards and Eric Clapton were out there digging around because they knew where they came from, I guess.
It's the British guys that found it first.
Yeah.
Because, we didn't know what it was. I mean, any of that music early on was referred to as grace music and not really paid attention to. And then, Keith Richards and all those guys, the British guys, Peter Green and all those guys, they were, digging in on it, and they found it first. And then, people, and we were wondering, and so they're the ones who told us, go, well, it's right in your own backyard and you didn't know it. And that's exactly true. It's how it happened. And then a lot of the other, some of the folk festivals like in Newport and all that, they started going, digging back and bringing out the older guys, like the traditional guys like Mississippi John Hurt and Sunhouse. And these guys started, getting a wide audience. And then, of course, B.B. King along the way, he played the Johnny Carson show a whole lot. So he had a lot of visibility that way, but it was, on that side of it, but then you didn't have the real juke joint thing going on. But a lot of the folk festivals, I think, exposed more of the traditional, blues, and that evolved into the other guys, showing up.
It's like you said earlier, it's kind of one of those, it's a little miracle. It could have all just
really
disappeared.
Is. That's for sure. And, it's out there. You just have to, really search for it. But it's out, it's still out there.
Well, Roger, you have been so generous with your time, and I really, really do appreciate it. We talked way back when your book came out, and it's been too long.
Well, it's been a while for sure, but I really appreciate you. This has been a lot of fun for me. I got to say that.
I'm glad. And if you get back out on the road and you find yourself, up here in the hills somewhere, please send me a note because I would dearly love to see you. I'd love to see you play and just love to see you.
No, no doubt. I'd love to. I guess this recording will be somewhere where I can go back and.
Oh, heavens!
Remember
yes.
What I said.
It'll go up at whiterosesociety.org. Under my page there, it'll go up on Podbean, and I will make sure that I message you a link to it, and you can share it out to friends and neighbors, and and maybe they'll have a little bit, maybe a little bit better picture of Roger Wilson in their mind. Our buddy Don just wrote in and said, "What memories? I saw the Allman Brothers in their early days at an upstairs venue in Richmond, the String Factory. Admission, $1.
Yeah, man.
A dollar.
No, you're right. Exactly. And what I was saying earlier, when I saw that concert in Atlanta, of course, the brothers were 75 miles down the road to Macon. And so they were playing free concerts in the park, and everybody knew who they were, and the show was sold out. But 2 months later, about 2 weeks after they recorded the Fillmore album, I was on vacation. They called it spring break, but in Jersey, when you go back to Jersey in March, it wasn't spring. But anyway, I was walking around a college. My dad and I were checking out the college I was going to go to for a year in Jersey, and I saw this flyer on this little gazebo thing, bulletin board, and I ran over and grabbed it. And it was the Allman Brothers, and they were coming through New Jersey. I was going, "Oh my God, I can't believe this!" And I told my dad, I said, "I've got to go see this. I got to see these guys." And I was flying back to Atlanta the next day on that Sunday, but this was on the Saturday night. And so I called the venue, which was it was called the Sunshine Inn in Asbury Park, New Jersey. And of course, Asbury Park has a big new connotation now, but then it was just a town that was near where I grew up. So I called the venue and I said, "Man, would please hold me two tickets, for the Allman Brothers band for Saturday night." He says, "Well, you won't have any problem because nobody knows who they are." And I said, "Well, I know who they are, and pretty soon you're going to know who they are." But I said, "In the meantime, just hold me two tickets anyway." And he said, "Okay, well, no problem." So I go over there, and I took some friend with me, and my friend that went with me, he didn't know what the hell I was talking about. He kept saying, he's going, "We're going to see the Allman Brothers." I'm going, no, it's not the Allman Brothers. It's the Allman Brothers. But just...
Sorry, that's not good.
Just hang loose, man. You'll dig it. Don't worry about it. And so we get in there, and the flyer, and I still had the flyer too, but anyway, we got in, and I'm sitting on the floor in the front, and this band is opening up, and these guys are like good players, but they're just crazy, man. They're having a blast. A couple of them are sitting in the back playing Monopoly on the stage on a table, and then the other guys are playing, they're playing some rock and roll tunes, and they're having a ball. And I'm going, "Man, these guys have got it going on." I don't know who they were, but it turned out it was Bruce Springsteen and Southside Johnny.
Oh, holy and, shit! Sorry.
Yeah, no kidding. That's what I said. And so they were just rocking out, and it was unbelievable. And they were just like guys from that era. Bruce had already been playing up and down for and this is in 71, March of 71, and Bruce has already been playing bars, at 18 and 19, before that. But I didn't know who they were, but I looked at the flyer after that, and I see this, I said, Bruce Springsteen. But I didn't know who Bruce Springsteen was, but I did now. So I was going, "Wow, these guys are having it, they're having a blast." And anyway, the Allman Brothers came in, and they walked like right in front of me, all of them. And they go into the back, and then they come out and played, and did Hoochie Coochie Man and Statesboro Blues and Don't Keep Me Wondering and just Whipping Post, Elizabeth Reed, the whole deal, the original band. And there was maybe 75 people in the place, maybe. And they were doing two shows, but I couldn't stay for the second show because I had to fly back to Atlanta the next day. But I did see that show, and I saw it. And then the next summer I came back home, Bruce had his own band called the Bruce Springsteen Band, and I've got the flyer from it. It was like $250 to get in, to see the Bruce Springsteen Band. And they were just all these guys just playing, having a great time playing music, and then one thing evolved into another. And then I went back to Georgia, and then I came back in 73, and Bruce released the first album, Greetings from Asbury Park. And I thought, "Wow, that's cool." Using the old postcard concept and doing that. And then when you listen to the album, it was all these words and, Blinded by the Light and all these great songs, but the words were like, just, you could tell he had been writing out of a rhyming dictionary, because that's what he said he did. He had a Rhyming Dictionary, and it was about ready to burst into flames because he was writing songs hand over fist. But the deal that he signed was more like a solo artist. In other words, I saw him playing rock and roll and playing a gold Les Paul and kicking and just rocking. And all this stuff came out because he got signed as he always wanted to have a band, but he got signed as a solo artist. And that's how that happened. But and I attribute it to the E Street. A lot of times the musicians will get a band together. Okay, let's get a band together, and then we learn some songs, and then we play. Well, Bruce had already written all the songs, and then he wanted a band after the record deal, and then he developed the E Street Band. So the E Street Band comes up around his songs, which is really a cool thing, a cool concept to have happen. And so that's how that evolved. And I consider it maybe a miracle or a privilege or just amazing that I was able to watch the Southern thing with the brothers and the Capricorn thing evolve, and then watch the Northern music evolve both sides, because I was going back and forth to school. And so I considered it that I was like, wow, I was really, in two places at once when two things were happening. And so it was, I still don't take that for granted. I go, well, yeah. And it's evolved into what it is now, with all that music, both North and South.
Yeah. Yeah. Without a doubt. I just had a note from Tracy who said, and Tracy, drives a cab. And she said, I drove Elijah Blue Allman home once and had no idea who he was until he handed me his Amex. So you're touching a lot of lives this evening, Roger, and I can't thank you enough. Again, well, I wish you well, and thank you.
Well, let's definitely stay in touch for sure.
Absolutely, and best of luck, and just keep on playing, keep rocking, keep making people smile, keep making people happy, because you do that for a lot of folks, and that's a magnificent way to make a living, making people smile. Thank you, Roger Wilson. Well, thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate you, and I appreciate your audience tuning in and asking questions and being willing to listen, and just however I can help anybody, just tell them to send me an email, and I'll do what I can.
Absolutely, and you've got a bunch of friends here. Anytime you want to chat, the door's open.
I appreciate it very much, man. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure, Roger. Take care and be well. Bye now.
You too. Thank you.
That's our buddy, Roger Wilson. Nobody like him. I remember, eager young newscaster guy that I was, and Roger was my producer, and Roger was on the other side of the booth with the microphone. And in 1 minute, thank you. 30 seconds, please. Thank you. 15 seconds, please. Thank you. 4, 3, 2, 1, boop, and the tone goes out, and the mute, and he makes the intro play. And we used to sit and talk rock and roll in between, because this would be like 3 o'clock in the morning. And just sit and talk rock and roll in between broadcasts, because I'd have most of my stuff written and just have to update it hourly, and that'd give you half an hour to just sit and jaw. I always enjoyed our conversations, and I enjoy them to this day. And so I'm really, really grateful to Roger for jumping in and having the conversation with us. Remember, if you'd like to get a signed copy of the new disc, go to HurricaneWilson.com, HurricaneWilson.com, and you can order it up there. Subscribe over at the YouTube channel, just Roger Wilson Guitar. It'll take you there. And I guarantee you, however you follow Roger, when he's doing something and he's streaming, or if he comes to somewhere near you, there is no better moment, no better time that you can spend than to go see him, or just sit there in the comfort of your own home and watch him just absolutely tear it up. Here's that one song that he recently uploaded, an old Hank Williams tune, Blues Come Around, Roger Wilson, live in Woodstock, Georgia.
times it be, but I let a gal make a fool of me. And ever since she let me down, the blues come around and the sun goes down. Oh, the blues come around. Oh, the blues come around. Oh, the blues come around. Every evening when the sun goes down. Since she left this town, the blues come around when the sun goes down. Oh, the blues come around. Oh, the blues come around. Oh, the blues come around every evening when the sun goes down. She tore them down. The blues come around when the sun goes down. Oh, the blues come around. Oh, the blues come around. Oh, the blues come around every evening when the sun goes down.
Listen to that all night long, and I may very well when the program's over. Again, Roger Hurricane Wilson, his new album is out, or will be out, on November the 1st via Blue Storm Records, and it is called A Spiritual Awakening, and I have a feeling it's going to be fantastic. So, by all means, check it out. It's kind of odd to segue back into the ordinary business of the day to day after something as refreshing and enlightening, informative, just happy, because there's so much craziness going on. And there's no lack of it. Let's see here. Stand by. Well, let's run over to the stress line and check in with Randy Radar. How you doing, Randy?
Hi, I'd like to throw back to the earlier portion of the program and the police and so forth.
Yeah.
Breonna Taylor was an EMT, as I understand it.
Yes, she was.
Was it? Yeah. I wonder what she knew that she wasn't supposed to know about, possibly.
You
know what I mean?
I don't think that's the case.
All right.
This was just an inept, brutal, hateful, racist police department with a long history of brutality and racism.
Right.
And, you know, remember, they weren't even going to her house. They went to the wrong place.
Right, yeah.
And that's how the whole thing came about. I don't think it was anything more or less than just the awfulness that transpired. Because frankly, I don't think anyone would have ever known about it if it had been, you know, something deep and dirty and covert.
Okay. All right. Well, you wouldn't know what goes on in hospitals, but apparently some of that stuff's pretty dirty too. So yeah.
Well, yeah, and it's, you know, pre-COVID, of course, but yeah. I'm guessing it's just bad racist cops get the wrong, you know, don't even have the right address. It's too embarrassing for it to have actually been some sort of botched political killing.
Okay, all right. And yet they call police law enforcement, and you say that, like, it seems like the judge is the law enforcement, and the police are just there to scoop up people.
Well, I mean, they're like I said before, they're in many instances they're the biggest gang in town.
Uh-huh.
They got more power, they got more guns, they got more ways to inflict damage than any of the gangs that that the particularly the right wing politicians will hoot and bark and grunt about. The cops are. And, you know, they like to think that I'm sure, you know, and, you know, always you have to, you know, not all cops, all of that stuff, but way too many cops. I mean, in the clip that we had at the beginning of the program, Randy, the guy is standing there asking, are we going to shoot somebody?
Right. Yeah.
And I don't know what kind of desperate man Shamar was that they were looking for, but they were, if you see the video later, that, you know, they're all gunned up and they're ready to have a shootout at the OK Corral.
Right. Yeah.
Because, you know, they never attack anybody their own size. They always come in with, you know, massive overwhelming force.
That's what I sort of gleaned from the Philadelphia uprising, or the uprising in cities or whatever. Like, the cops are on the TV saying, well, we're not going out there because they're outmanned 10 to 1, you know. Like, with unarmed protesters, they're outmanned 10 to 1, afraid to go out on the streets, you know. So,
Well, and they do that to terrorize the public, Randy. You know, some right wing radio host will be blathering about, you know, there are certain sections of the city that the police won't go into. Bullshit.
Right.
You know, they can roll in there with a dozen cruisers for a jaywalker, and they don't mind to do it.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, even in a place like this, it's nothing for me to see, you know, some poor soul who's got the wrong license plates, and they'll be pulled over on the side of U.S. 19 over in Fayetteville, and there'll be three cruisers around them.
Yeah. If they're black, there'll be eight cruisers around them.
Yeah, right. Or if they've got a really wrong license plate, like, say, old Florida.
Yeah.
They bring out, you know, they come with everything they've got.
Right. So law enforcement seems to be an Orwellian term, at least a bit, because they're not really bound to enforce the law.
Well, court case after court case has shown that they are not bound to protect anybody.
Right. Yeah. Okay. This is the additional manufactured chaos because you've got student loans, nursing home bills, and $7.25 an hour in between. So the answer of the right wing is just pile on more police officers on all these social problems that situation engenders.
Well, it's a matter of different ways of looking at a problem.
Yeah.
If you just want to gun up and add more cops, that means that you have no intention of ever actually solving the underlying problem.
Right, yeah. Well, Well, your bugaboo is male domination. Mine is narcissist, and I'd like to go into that a little bit.
Go right ahead.
Well, it's a newly explored field, actually. They're revisiting, actually, the psychological studies of the past and revising them with new research. The three favorite phrases of narcissists is, the first one is, I don't believe you, okay? The second one is, you're crazy. This is crazy making talk. Getting people to believe they're crazy when they may not necessarily be so, okay? The third one is, you can't make it without my help, to keep you in the fold. Generally speaking, narcissists are ultra-controlling and exploit the otherwise healthy doubt that exists in otherwise weak-willed individuals who are bending over backwards to be fair, and the narcissists are toxic to the other individuals. They actually steal your energy for their own self-aggrandizement.
And a perfect example of that was when Trump stood up there at his 2016 Republican National Convention, you know, with all those Russians hanging around.
Yeah.
And said, I alone can fix it.
Right. And you can't make it without my help portion of it. Like,
yeah.
So they constantly need to be praised, and they constantly, well, you see, there are different types of narcissists. Women fall prey to these people because they love the narcissist will love bomb them, and they'll be so spectacular at doing so with their fascinating lives and so forth. Now the typical ones are 6% of narcissists are malignant narcissists like CEOs and Trump. Okay, approximately 6%. Of the population are malignant narcissists. Then there are the grandiose narcissists who try to puff themselves up to be more than they are, and social media feeds this. And then there are the intellectual narcissists who try to be the smartest people. And if you're not, that's their thing, to be the smartest people around. Of course, there's always someone smarter than them. Okay, and a lot of women marry or get love bombed by the male narcissist, or sometimes the other gender around, and they fall in love with the narcissist, and then the love bombing gradually stops and the criticism starts in, and they can melt into a puddle, psychological puddle, under the narcissist's control. Okay, and I wonder. Now, my particular situation involved two narcissists within the family, and I was wondering why one of the parental narcissists, when I was growing up, my answers were never really good enough for them. Okay, and I would try to give them better answers, and I didn't realize until a friend pointed out to me about 5 years ago or so, what was going on with a narcissist and why they were behaving the way they did. A narcissist will never take the blame for anything. It's always somebody else's fault. Okay, so you saw that in Trump. Okay, it's always some scapegoat's fault. Not necessarily a marginalized community, but with a narcissist, it's someone else's fault. Okay, and right. They also turn something around on the person who has doubt, healthy doubt, and say, if you land a criticism on them, they will turn it around and say, well, you do the same thing too, leaving the doubtful person to say, well, maybe I do, and swinging back into a corner. Because a narcissist does not have self-interest. Introspection.
Yeah.
A narcissist does not have introspection, incapable of introspection for the most part. Okay. And a lot of psychologists or psychiatrists who the victims go to will actually tell them that the person loves them and do more damage to the victim that way. because they're going to they're going in couples therapy or they're going by themselves seeking relief, and they don't get it. They get blamed. They get blame the victim type of thing. Okay, so because it's not in the DSM unless it's one of these classical cases. You know, it's not the more common cases of narcissism. So going to therapy doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get help from the therapist. And the narcissist is usually a charmer, okay, and can sometimes con the therapist into blaming the victim.
Oh, any, yeah, and if they're good,
yeah.
they absolutely can.
Right.
But the person who's dealing with it, you know, we can say this much, the therapy may not help. But not going to therapy definitely won't help.
Right. Yeah. So you see, they can actually damage you more than you normally would be by going to help and getting the victim getting blamed for the situation. Now, speaking of blame, one of the things the narcissists won't do, and that's the fourth one, is they will not take the blame. As I said, they'll shift it off onto someone else.
Yeah, and it's like okay. It's like every one of these elements that you mentioned, Randy, we've got we can point to 4 years of Trump and say, well, yeah, okay, we saw that in action, we saw that in action, we saw that in action. They won't take blame; it's always somebody else's fault.
Right.
I mean, we've had a 4-year masterclass in narcissism.
But I'm wondering if most of the Congress, a good portion of the Congress, aren't narcissists. Okay. I'm wondering if.
Yeah, well, you know, there's that study that was done, and the word that was bandied about back in that was just psychopath. A statistically higher than the general population percentage of CEOs are psychopaths. Psychopaths occur
right.
in greater proportion in the CEO subset than they do in the general population. And, you know, you ask about members of Congress, the elected officials. When you get up there in the thin oxygen,
yeah,
ambition, and I think we tend to see it more on the right wing side of things because I think we're inclined to see it there. You know, ambition outweighs. I mean, how many people, Randy, can we talk about? I mean, there's Jim Jacketoff Jordan. Louis Asparagus Gomer, you know, they're not there because of their vast intellect. They're there because
yeah.
they are in maybe it's the right word, insanely ambitious and perhaps cupiditous and avaricious. You know, whatever agenda they when you come into office with an agenda of hurting other people, there's something there's already something essentially wrong with you.
Right.
And so I think it probably once again, it's probably, and this is pure speculation, but it probably occurs in a greater proportion than it does in the general population. But I'm no psychotherapist,
well,
I'm no psychologist, and I don't play one on the radio. I'm just guessing.
I would think much greater, you know, not just slightly greater, but much greater. Now, when dealing with narcissists, they say you can go gray rock, and you know what that means?
No.
Gray rock means you become so bland and uninteresting and non-feedbackable that the narcissist loses interest in you. Okay. And then you cut off contact after going gray rock. Okay. And there's something the narcissists do called hoovering. And what that means is they will be nice. They'll call you up and be nice to you after a period of no contact. And they will try to hoover you like a vacuum back into their circle. Okay.
Yeah.
So, gray rock is one phrase. Hoovering is another phrase. Gray rock is a defensive measure against a narcissist. No contact is the ultimate defensive measure against a narcissist. And hoovering is when they say, hey, I lost control of this individual. Maybe I better get him back into my circle, you know. So I have two relatives who have at least one incidence of spousal abuse under their belt. And I had to clean up the situation in both cases. Okay?
Yeah.
Because finally, like the marriage went south or whatever, and marriage went south. And immediately, one of the relatives was back into the marriage market trying to find a new source of narcissistic supply. All right, every time he lost a wife, he'd be back into the market trying to find another source of narcissistic supply, and he would love bomb the next wife. This kept repeating itself over and over again. So they have to be praised. They constantly have to be praised, okay, or control somebody in order to feel worthy, in order to cover up a sense of shame. So I don't know. There's more to it than that, but there are resources on YouTube for surviving narcissism.
Okay.
And the
nature of this community is such that that may prove helpful to somebody.
Well, women are particularly susceptible to being drawn into this because they fall in love, I guess, more than men do. Men have a physical need, and the women fall in love more passionately, and like they will fall for the love bombing of the narcissist, and then slowly it starts to turn around on them, and they find themselves under the spell of the narcissist. And before you know it, they can't make any decision on their own without aggravating the narcissist. So, and the narcissist, as soon as sometimes they'll grow bored of their narcissistic supply, and they'll just throw the person away. But more likely, they'll keep them within their control. And, will keep hoovering them back into their control until the victim makes a clean break from it. Now, one of the phrases you can do when a narcissist is attacking you is you can use the phrase, two phrases I've learned. The first one is whatever. Okay, sound like a valley girl and just say whatever. Like, I don't care what you're saying. It's critical of me. The second one is you can say it's neither here nor there, okay? But when you're being attacked, your automatic defense is to defend yourself, and you have to train yourself to get away from that and just say whatever or it's neither here nor there, okay? And like that defuses the situation to a point where you become uninteresting and you're not supplying them with their narcissistic. Now, if you actually blame them for something, they will have two responses. They will either fall silent on something, or they will lash out at you. A lot of narcissists, when they are blamed for something, will become passive-aggressive. Okay? So, there are excellent resources on YouTube. One's called Surviving Narcissism. The other is Dr. Romani's channel. And the third one is a woman who has a book out called The Road Back to You and survived a marriage and a teenage son but from the marriage, being married to this narcissist, raging narcissist. So I hope those resources help someone in your communities experience this. And as I said, not all psychologists or psychiatrists are trained in the new study of this.
No, that's one of the things that, and not just this topic, but others, that we're going to be dealing with for a long time after COVID. And this program is one of the few places I've heard it discussed, is the desperate need for broader counseling and therapy skill sets for the people who have dealt in the front lines, whether it's at a grocery store or in a hospital. The PTSD that's going to come from that, because one of the things I pointed out in the past decade is that with the rise of the opioid crisis, almost all it's and we have friends who work in behavioral health. It has demanded so much of the behavioral health system, the opioid crisis and addiction issues, that it's almost as though there is It was already past capacity when COVID hit, and
yeah.
What comes after is going to be even more of a more compelling and more of a challenge.
Right.
So I think your information is well placed and well shared. Randy, have yourself a good night. It is always a pleasure talking with you. And
Thank you very much.
We will, I hope, talk soon. Take care.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Bye now. Our buddy Randy Radar. I wouldn't be surprised if some of us have something approaching, as in tens of millions, some sort of post-traumatic issues arising out of the last 4 years. You know, being constantly afraid of someone or something takes a terrible toll. And while the maggots were reveling in their cruelty, people with decent functioning brains and souls and beings were worrying not just about themselves, but about people they loved and otherwise cared about. I mean, if you just take a moment and think of all the various groups that Nitwit Nero attacked over the course of 4 years, women in general, ethnicities that weren't his in general, and all the various and sundry communities and subgroups, it would to wonder we're not a quivering wreck. And when you put that side by side with the fact that he tried to overturn the government, that's a ton of stress. A lot. Oh, and thank you to Matt in San Francisco. Matt said, talking about the conversation with Roger, Matt said, that was great. That was a great palate cleanser. I feel refreshed. I did too. Still do. And maybe I just need to focus on bringing a little bit more of that to the program once in a while. I think that would be wonderful. Let's run over to check in with Tracy. Hey, Tracy, how are you?
You're
what have I done?
Oh, nothing. I'm just, you know, while I was listening to Randy, I'm like, does he know Jan?
Quit that. You're on the air.
She don't listen. And I told her about herself, so he was just confirming my diagnosis.
Fair enough.
What?
No, nothing. Nothing. Nothing.
What did I say?
No, you said. So, are you out at the airport? Do I hear jets in the background?
No. I'm dry. I'm not. My windows are open, and I'm just about to drop off my third of the couple more people that I have to drop off. So, ooh.
Well, I got
to
know how long ago did you have Elijah Blue Almond in the in your camp?
Jesus, this was a million years ago. This is before I became, because this is when I was driving cab in Santa Monica before I can become before I started driving quote unquote for the city of Los Angeles through LADOT. When I could only pick up in like Santa Monica and Marina Del Rey and Culver City. I couldn't pick up at LAX and stuff like that. But it was funny because the kid gets in my cab. I picked him up in Santa Monica. He gets in my cab. I mean, this has to be 2001. It was pre 9/11. And kid gets in my cab. And he gave me the address. I mean, and this is like pre-GPS. I actually have to use my Thomas guy to look up the address. And so it was up PCH in Malibu. And he hands me his credit card. And I looked. I'm like, Elijah Blue Altman. I'm like, Altman. I'm like, holy crap. I'm like, that's because I mean, and I knew. Do it on the outside. Oops, hold on. Yeah. Close enough. I knew.
Tracy. She muted herself. Okay. There you are. No.
Damn it. Okay. I knew who it was. And then I'm like, oh my God. And then I realized I was dropping. And then I double realized I was dropping him off at his mom's house in Malibu. Mom being Cher.
I was going to say, and mama is?
Cher. And I'm like, whoa. It's those things that when, you know, when you live and work in L.A. and for what I do for a living, you are going to run into a celebrity or two. I mean, I've met Jean-Claude Van Damme. I've driven Jimmy Smits. I've met Alfre Woodard. I've met Don Cheadle. Who else? Oh, a couple of other people. But the only two I really care about. Oh, Lynn Bigpen. The only three people that I care about. Lynn Bigpen, Don Cheadle. And Jimmy Smits. Because Jimmy Smits was so awesome. It was just like, wow. I mean, it's when you meet a celebrity person in that, and they're as cool as you hope they're going to be, that just, it just makes your day. Because, like, did I ever tell you the Jimmy Smith story?
I don't think so.
So, again, this is when I was driving in Santa Monica, and I picked him up at Brentwood. Now, I'm not supposed to pick him up at Brentwood, but whatever. And it was early, early, early in the morning, so it was still dark. And I got to the pickup really early, and I dozed off waiting for them to come out. And so they walk out, and they knocked on the window, and I went to go. I'm sorry. So I go to get out the car to help them with their luggage. And they're like, oh, no. Don't worry about it. You know, I got it. And I'm like, okay. So I get back. He didn't even let me get out the car. So I had no idea who was in my car. So, you know, we're having a nice conversation. And they were in like Brentwood, Pacific Palisades. So we're heading, you know, east up off the sunset to the 405, get on the 405, head to LAX. And as the sun is coming up, I'm looking. And I look in my rearview mirror, and I'm like, Jimmy Smits is in the back of my car. So I didn't freak out. I mean, this is when.
No, when you drive cab in LA, you're just cool about that. Oh, yeah, Jimmy Smits is in the cab.
No, but see, this is when he was. This was Jimmy Smits when he was on the West Wing. And at the time, I had no idea because I hadn't been watching the West Wing. I didn't start watching the West Wing until years later. But anyway, but I had the Jimmy Smits that I had in my head was L.A. Law Jimmy Smits, right?
Right.
Fine as hell, Jimmy Smits.
Fine as frog's hair.
It's fine as frog's hair. So, you know, we're talking and everything. So, we get out the car, you know, we get to the LAX, and John Shuck was there waiting for him.
Get out.
I'm like, dude. But again, didn't realize the significance of it because, again, Mama Tracy wasn't watching
the West Wing.
So I had no idea that, you know, but I know who John Shuck was. So I'm like, okay. But anyway, so... I get out and I said, you know, Mr. Schmidt, I've always been a fan. I loved you on L.A. Law. That's probably why he looked at me like sideways. Like, well, bitch, you don't watch, you know, I'm doing what's wrong? What do I need to update my resume? What's up with this? So anyway, and he was so gracious. He wouldn't even let me take his luggage out the car. he wouldn't even let me, you know, so he's like, so he goes, oh, darling, thank you, thank you, thank you. And he took me by the, he took my hand and kissed me on my hand.
Didn't wash it for a week, did you?
Baby. I almost damn near passed out right then and there. And he gave me a $20 tip on top of that.
Not shabby.
Not shabby. And this is, you know, 2020.
Yeah.
I mean, 2000, you know, 2000. So it's like, yeah, nicest guy. And the Jean-Claude Van Damme thing was, so he, I was first up at a hotel, and he was, they called me up, and he was putting one of his female friend in the cab, and she wasn't quite ready yet. And he's like, asked me how much, I forget where I was taking her. And I said, whatever, how much it was. And he's like, okay. And he's like, well, go ahead and start the meter because she's not quite ready yet. I'm like, okay, fine. And still waiting and still waiting. So he gave me, for me waiting there, he's like, well, here's a 20 for you waiting, but keep the meter going. And I'm like, cool. And then when she finally came down, the meter had only clicked to like $5. And so when she finally came down, he's like, here's another 20 for being so patient. And whatever, because I think whatever, I forget where I was taking her, but whatever the estimate was, he's like, here's however much. So basically, I think where I was taking her might have been a $20 cab ride. So he gave me like $60 for a $20 cab ride.
You know, that's a sign of good. That's a sign of a good caddy.
Right. It's like, but the thing, you know, it's one of those things, because I'm like, I don't know his reputation. I know nothing about, you know, what people think of him or whatever. But I'm like, look, because to me, that's like he valued my time. He's like, you know, this is your job. I appreciate the fact that you're waiting. And just because, you know, you're a cab driver does not mean that your time is not valuable.
Well, it's easy to forget because of the celebrity status. It's easy to forget you're talking about union workers. And union workers tend to value other union workers' time.
But see, remember, that's not a problem. You know, cab drivers here, we're not union.
Right. But I mean, it's still, right. if somebody is a union member, I think they tend to be a little more mindful.
Yeah, and one of my first jobs, I was a union worker. I was a cashier at Ralph's. And
right.
Like you said, I'm very mindful of people's time. And, you know, I care about, that's why I tip. That's why I, you know, because it's like, all labor has value. And just, my brother-in-law and I get into it about all labor has value. And my brother-in-law and I, you know, that's one of our biggest fights about, well, you know, why should somebody get paid this much money for flipping a bird? I said, oh, so just because you fly a plane,
is he not a member of the pilots union?
That part.
I mean, there's a whole lot of people who aren't pilots who make planes go. I want happy baggage handlers. I want happy mechanics.
I want happy baggage handlers. I want my luggage to get from A to B to Z to K to whatever.
And not be in pieces. Yeah.
I want my food or whatever on the plane. I want the ticket handlers. I want and I definitely want happy air traffic controllers. I want happy everybody. And I just don't get, so these people like the police and these maggot police people and fire people, all of them, especially the police union, and one of the strongest unions in the country. But they don't want no one else to have a union. I'm like, yeah, bastard.
Well, that's so why I don't think cop unions. I don't think cop unions are real unions.
No, I think they're just. I think they're just a gang. So when I was sounding really exasperated, my brother who has been borrowing my car. So yeah, he was in an accident today, and I sent you the pictures.
Yeah, he's okay, right? I mean, he's still okay.
He's fine. And I have full coverage insurance. I'm not tripping. And it didn't look as bad. Oh, by the way, the police were called, so there is a police report. Well, here's the deal. Apparently, the damage is worse than we thought. Something about the brake line and the axle and something else. So the car... my insurance adjuster called me today, and I don't know. They're going to have their people come and look at the car at my auto body shop and go from there.
Oh God, fingers crossed. You know, I gotta tell you. You know, the stories that people tell on this program get other people thinking.
Uh huh.
So I just got a lovely note from Dave Number 11.
Uh-huh.
Who says, "I don't want to walk on Tracy. There are stories of good celebrities and bad ones. My best one was on the set of The Russians Are Coming. The Russians Are Coming. I know. I remember that film.
How old is he?
Now quit that. Dave says, Jonathan Winters spent lots of time improvising for the onlookers when they weren't shooting scenes. One time, Alan Arkin was handing out candy to the kids while Winters was holding court. I was 5 years old and hit Arkin up for about 7 pieces of butterscotch. That's just sweet.
Butterscotch, Arkin,
sweet. See what I did there?
And no respect. Alan Arkin seems like a cool guy. Now, I've met Adam, and I don't know. He was at a Starbucks in L.A. years back, and I was going to say something to him, and I just got this feeling like,
nah.
Maybe no. You know, that's just... Because I just think he's hilarious. But there was something about him, and I'm like, no. I'm gonna pass.
Yeah, sometimes you just kind of vibe on when to not. Yeah.
But the best one. Well, between Alfred Woodard and Lynn Thigpen. So Alfred Woodard, one day, so I did pull up to this house in Santa Monica, and this beautiful light-skinned girl gets in my cab, right? And so she's getting in the cab, and she looks down and she realizes, oh, crap, I left something in the house. And she's like, I said, well, go ahead, go back in it, you know. I hadn't turned on the meter or anything like that. And so she's like, oh, no, I turned on the meter. And I said, you know, I hit the time off on it. I said, go ahead, go back in and get it. And so she runs back in the house. As she runs back in the house, out walks Alfred Woodard. Oop. Now, Alfred Woodard is, to me, just everything. I mean, she's the kind of person, Alfred Woodard is one of those people, like her and Viola Davis and Angela Bassett. Had they been around when I was a little girl, I would have considered becoming an actress. That's just how much I love these women, okay? So, and like I said, very rarely do I approach celebrities because... I don't want to bother them, you know, but it was Alfred Woodard. So
I can see that. Yeah.
And I get out my cab and I say, Miss Woodard, I said, I'm going to apologize right now. I'm gushing. She just laughed. I said, I love you. I love you. I love you. You are everything that I think an actress should be and is. You are underrated and underappreciated. You were robbed when they didn't give you the Oscar. She was dying. And I'm like, and I said, my favorite movie, I said at the time, because I said, there's only basically two movies by Spike Lee that I like, and you're in one of them, and it's Crooklyn. And she's like, that's, she's like, oh my God. And she hugged me. And I said, oh my God. I said, you know, that just, you know, so when the girl got back in my cab, I said, okay, dish sis. How do you know Alfre Woodard? And she's like, I said, is she your mom? And she's like, no, she's my godmother. So the story was Alfre Woodard and her mom were in the original Broadway production of For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When a Rainbow Was Not Enough. And they did a tour of Australia. So what had happened was, there was a guy there in Australia, must have been a cutie pie. They both liked him, but come to find out, he liked the girl's mom more. So her mother wound up staying in Australia and marrying the guy. And now that's how she became Alfre Woodard's goddaughter.
How awesome.
The first thing out of my mouth was, "Girl, what did you want me to do for hair product?"
Because of course.
Because I'm me, and she's like, "Yeah, that was a problem." because this was, you know, this is definitely before the internet and Amazon and all that. She's like, lots of packages, you know, from home. So yeah, and then my Lynn Thigpen story. Was she's walking down the street in Santa Monica and just minding her business. And I accosted her because I've loved her forever. And I asked her, I said, how did it feel playing that awful woman in Lean on Me? And she's like, it was the most fun I've ever
had. Oh, it's always more fun to play a villain. Villains are a blast.
Yeah, she's like, that was the most fun I have ever had in my entire life. Because she's like, I don't get to play the villain, you know, because, you know, she was the voice in Warriors, the DJ. That was her voice. And Carmen San, you know, and she was on, you know, Carmen San Diego, because she has that, she had that amazing voice. And then like a couple of weeks later, she passed away. So I cherish and treasure that because I actually had a chance to meet her before she died.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, but she, you know, just I did another one, I forget. You know who Jennifer Lewis is, right?
Yes.
So you know the character she plays? How, you know, she's basically, you know, the you know, don't mess with me, badass black woman?
Yes.
No nonsense, whatever. That the character that she plays, that is how she is. She is unapologetically black. I met her. She's like, look, girl. She said, come on over here and sit on down with me. I'm just having a glass of wine. You want a glass of wine? Come on now. She's like, look, I don't care what people. She's authentic. She's wonderful. She's just amazing. So it's like, so it's, yeah, I've fortunately for me, every celebrity that I've ever met has been cool. And, you know,
that's just because you've never had James Woods in your cab.
And that, you know what, that would break my heart. Because I didn't know that he was crazy until I started listening to your show. And then I started doing my own research. And I was just like, oh, man.
Because that's one of those instances where you can do your own research.
Right, right, right. And I'm like, no, he can't be that bad. And then I started reading about him.
Yep.
And it's like him and Vince Vaughn and what's the other fool? The Lethal Weapon.
Mel Gibson?
Mel Gibson. I'm like, oh, man. I mean, these are the people that you're like, these are the people that you watch. And I mean, because I thought Vince Vaughn with his, sarcasm and stuff. So you I just thought that was a character that you played. So you really are an asshole.
Ouch. I know. Hey, I gotta wrap things up, but I gotta giggle for us at the end. Poor little because I get so much fun out of these stupid press releases from Nitwit Nero.
Oh no.
We got a fresh one. He is now in. I guess he's campaigning in Brazilian politics.
Mm.
Do you have any idea how many there are?
Does he even know where Brazil is?
I think there may be one of those Trump flea bags in somewhere in Rio or whatever. I don't know. But Jair Bolsonaro, the Brazilian national legislature is trying to limit his ability to be on social media because he's such a dick. He's a genuine Professor Spicoli, you dick. Yeah, genocidal impulses toward indigenous people, the works, racist as fuck. So, just moments ago, I get this press release out of Save America, again, some more. And it just, the title of it reads, Endorsement of President Jair Bolsonaro. Really? You're endorsing the president of Brazil? You're endorsing... is it a paid endorsement, dipshit? President Jair Bolsonaro and I have become great friends over the past few years. He fights hard for and loves the people of Brazil, just like I do for the people of the United States. Brazil is lucky to have a man such as Jair Bolsonaro working for them. He's a great president, and will never let the people of his great country down. You know what's going on here, right?
Mm.
He's trying to make sure. He's trying to make sure that he can take it on the lam to Brazil if he gets his ass, mm-hmm. orange ass indicted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do we have extradition with Brazil?
Oh, probably not.
Because mm-hmm. I'm thinking, boys of Brazil. Doctor, that is like, ooh, that movie with
Gregory Peck and
Gregory and Sir Laurence Olivier, man, Dr. Mangala. Ooh,
evil.
That movie was creepy as hell.
Yes.
Oh God, I'm about to go see if I can find that because man. See, watching that movie now, because I saw it, when it first came out at the actual movies and kind of having an idea of what it was about. But now watching it now, considering the last 4 years.
It's a different movie, isn't it?
It's a whole different movie. And especially what you just said about, the non-extradition country and stuff like that. So... I might have to give it another watch because
creepy. Yeah.
Creepy. Creepy hashtag creepy ass.
Creepy AF.
Creepy AF.
But I just saw that. I just had to share that because it's so freaking pathetically funny. Had a lovely note from Sister Jude. What an uplifting horn robin with each and every one closing with Tracy's laughter. One can sense the smile on her face. Yes, uplifting. Thanks to all. Thank you, Jude. Thank you so much.
And I wanted to say, hey, Jude. And I know she gets tired of hearing people say, hey,
I know,
Jude, but I
know,
can't help it. I enjoyed your conversation yesterday, you and Todd's conversation yesterday was awesome. And I don't think I've ever actually heard your voice. Oh, my God. I felt like...
Hey, your blood pressure comes down 10 points.
I was like, did I just do, like, deep breathing exercises without doing deep breathing exercises?
That's why Jude is the Horns spiritual advisor.
Lord of mercy. I was like, wow, I have never felt so calm. I said, so I think you need to come on every day, especially while I'm driving, just to calm my nerves. So thank you, Jude.
Be good and good for you. Tracy, I hope things work out with the car. I'm so... Oh, my God. Yeah, because you needed that.
I have insurance, and the best, like I said, my baby brother's okay, and that's all that matters to me.
Sure.
I can replace my car. I cannot replace my baby brother. And he would kick my butt.
And it was somebody else's fault.
That part.
People. I mean, sometimes, anyway. Sometimes people really do just, suck.
Yes.
Oh, by the way, one last thing.
Mm-hmm.
Agnes and I watched Dune last night because Scary Jerry has been emailing me, stop everything, see Dune. Never mind the football, see Dune. We watched Dune last night.
And I tried, but I'm like, I was tired, and I'm like, this is something you cannot watch if you're tired. So it seems,
it's a big beautiful
TV with the surround sound
it's
and all
beautiful,
that.
And the score, the soundtrack, and the cast is amazing.
But and have you watched G-Force yet?
I have watched a few episodes of yes.
And?
Not bad.
Okay, I mean, it's just something to watch when you're like, I need to watch something to get rid of the blogs.
You mean Q-Force?
Yeah, Q-Force. Why don't you call them? Because I'm thinking gay.
Yeah, no.
Q-Force.
Yeah, I've seen a few episodes. Dune, one of the things that Jerry in particular pointed out was, oh my God, the ornithopters will blow your mind. And they did. The special effects, right? I was absolutely convinced that there was an airfield somewhere that had a bunch of those sitting on it, and I want those to exist in the real world.
Because now you're going off sci-fi geek.
Yeah, I know.
It's time to go because you're going all sci-fi geeky girl nerdy person.
I'm gonna put my nerd girl glasses on in a minute.
And you're going all nerdy and all that. Oh, and you know what? Another reason why it annoyed me that I wasn't going to watch it is because I found out that they're going to Lord of the Rings me on that shit, and that pisses me off because I'll get into it, and then what do you mean? They're going to have to make another movie and then another one, and I'm like, you sons of really? I call bullshit.
I understand.
I hate that shit. So anyway, I love you.
Have a beautiful evening.
And there won't be a show tomorrow.
Right.
Because you got. I will be listening on
Thursday. Precisely.
Always.
You have a lovely evening. Drive carefully. Watch out. Keep an eye on the rearview mirror. Oh, God.
And maybe next time I look in the rearview mirror, Jimmy Smits will be back there.
Click your heels 3 times, Tracy.
Yeah, my heels 3 times.
All right. Good night, dear. Oh, by the way, Jude says, hey, girl.
So, hey, go ahead.
Hey, go hi. be good, Tracy. Talk to you soon.
What's the fun in that?
I know. It's for appearance's sake.
Oh, okay, fine.
All right. Talk to you later.
Bye.
And that's Tracy, the lady cab driver, wrapping up what I hope was a delightful program. It was for me. I hope it was for you as well. And thank you so much to Roger Wilson for joining us in conversation. I love talks like that. Thanks, everybody. We didn't do anything in terms of bringing down the fundraising goal during the show, but that's okay. So tomorrow we'll be at 7:50. Thursday we'll be at 7:50. And hopefully we'll finish October okay. Thank you so much. Thanks to all of our PayPal and Patreon subscribers. Thank you so much. And thank you to our a la carte contributors. Thank you to each and every one of you who shares your precious finite time engaging in the program in whatever manner you so choose. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to Sparky in the chat room. I think it would have been really cool if Steve had been by. I hope maybe he'll check out the... yeah, Steve was in there. Thanks for being in there, Steve from Georgia Stan, Brother Bishop Steve. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Roger. You know, he's not that awful far from where you are. If you get a chance to catch him play, and you really, really should, fantastic. Thanks to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, HeadOn.live, brand new Fresh Malloy on the way at 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 6 p.m. Pacific. The best place to listen to the first run of Malloy is HeadOn.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. 20 plus years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. This would be a great time to reach out to your member of the House of Representatives. Ask them to co-sponsor H.R. 2073, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. It means the world to Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Stay safe. Get your booster, get your vaccines, wash your hands, don't touch your face. Avoid big super spreader events, avoid maggots. They are known carriers and malignant, disastrously unconcerned spreaders. Maintain your social distance. Wear your mask. We're back to it again, like I said. For God's sakes, if somebody comes toward you saying, well, no, I didn't help plot the insurrection, but if some of my staff might have, and if they did, I'm real proud of them. Avoid that person like the plague. Because he is. Later.